Frustrated into the goddamn word for it. This is bullshit. Everybody in that goddamn dressing room knows that I'm the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be.
Those of you just tuning in might say, what the hell am I watching?
Wait a minute, what the hell is this? What the hell is this? No tall, get beer, no tall with a beer bat.
I mean, it's a good thing I got up. Because it was Little Taker coming down the stairs. I stopped him just in time. And then it took two more steps. Didn't see his mama's feet. One of them was in New York, and the other one was in LA.
Welcome to a very special episode of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com, episode 228. I am Solomonster. Monday Night Raw, of course, coming up on its 1,000th episode on July 23rd, which is a huge milestone. If you just watch any episode of Raw over the last couple of weeks, WWE has been shoving all these different facts in your face about how it's the longest-running television show of all time, blah, 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 which, of course, is not exactly true, but doesn't take away from how impressive an accomplishment it is for Raw to be on the air as long as the show has been. So, in honor of Raw celebrating its 1,000th episode, I decided that what I would do is take it upon myself to put together a little bit of a countdown. Now, I have seen basically every single Raw episode, unless I've missed one and I'm unaware of it. I, like probably many of you, have seen every Raw episode going back to 1993. And keep in mind, I didn't have cable television until late 1995. So I've gone back, obviously, since that time and watched many of those old Raw shows. And there have been a lot of great Raw episodes. There have been a lot of not-so-great Raw episodes. And while it would be very easy for me to sit here, and actually I shouldn't even say that, with all the shitty Raw moments that we've had over the years, it probably would be pretty tough for me to put a list together of the top 20 or top 50 worst Raw moments. You can kind of look at that both ways. It would be very tough, it would be very easy, because there's been a lot of bad stuff on this show. So what I'm going to do here is look at the positive. There have been a lot of great matches, a lot of great moments, and what I've done is I've put together a list of the top 30 greatest moments in the history of Monday Night Raw, going all the way back to the debut show in 1993. Now, what I mean by moments, moments can encapsulate a lot of different things. Moments can be quite literally a moment. It could be the finish to a match. It could be a certain move that was executed in a match. It could be some shocking twist in a storyline or an angle. Or it could be something more than that. Maybe it could be a match. There really is no set definition of what a moment is relative to this list. What I know I did not want to do was do a top 30 matches list. So this is not a list of matches. There's been a lot of great matches in the history of Raw. A lot of them are not going to be mentioned here because that's not what this list is about. Of course, this list is also very subjective. Your list will probably look a lot different than my list. In putting this list together, I wanted to put it in some sort of order. So this is a ranked list. This is not a list of 30 random moments. This is the top 30 moments in Raw history ranked from number 30 all the way up to the number 1 moment. And that's how we're going to work this list. Now, let me also mention here that I did not include any tribute shows in this list because, to me, it would be far too easy to do that. You know, we've seen tributes for Brian Pillman, Owen Hart, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, and maybe one or two others I'm neglecting to mention here. They were all done in good taste, at least mostly they were done in good taste. They were all very well put together, very emotionally charged, and they were very good in their own respects. So it would kind of, I feel, taint the list in a way, because how do you put, let's say, something from the Eddie Guerrero tribute show at number 19, you know, on a list? So I am excluding all material from the tribute shows over the years because, quite frankly, it's depressing, and they don't really have any place on this list. They were all very Very well done. They have their own special moments, but they're not part of this list. So before anybody, you know, mentions that, I'm leaving them out for a reason. So without any further ado, let's get into the list here again. The top 30 moments in Raw history, according to yours truly, the Solemn Monster. This is my own personal list. I have my own personal reasons for picking the things that I have chosen, and it was not easy. It was not an easy thing to put this list together. The initial list, of course, morphed into something else, which morphed into something else, and then I said, you know what, if I wait any longer, this whole list is going to look different. So let me just go ahead and get this show over with here. And as far as why 30, originally I was thinking maybe a top 20 or 25, but quite frankly, there were too many moments I did not want to leave out, and there were still a lot of moments I left out. If I had a roll call of honorable mentions, it would be as long as my arm, so I'm not going to do that. 30 was a nice round number, so that's the number I decided to go with. So, rounding off the list at number 30 is a moment that, quite frankly, I wasn't sure if I was actually going to put this on my list or not, because anybody who's listened to my podcast knows I have not been the biggest fan of the guest host gimmick on Raw, which of course started a couple of years ago, and it's kind of tapered off. They only have guest hosts every now and then. But there was one guest host in particular, and there were actually a couple that I liked, Bob Barker, of course, being among them, but there was one guest host in particular back on the November 23rd, 2009 edition of Monday Night Raw that WWE brought in that was quite unexpected, but a pleasant surprise for longtime wrestling fans, and that, of course, was Jesse the Body Ventura. Now, Jesse Ventura has had a lot of ups and downs with WWE, and specifically Vince McMahon. They've had the really the definition of what you would call a love-hate relationship over the years, and that one minute they'll love each other, the next minute they hate each other. And Jesse was brought in, I believe he was probably brought in to promote either a book or a new TV show. That might have been around the time he was promoting his new Conspiracy Theories TV show. I don't really remember. But anyway, Jesse came in. He was the special guest host for Raw that night. And one thing that they had Jesse do on this show is something that I will always remember, because I grew up a fan of the WWF, and I remember the days of the old Saturday night's main event shows, and you'd have Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura doing commentary, and quite frankly, you know, Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, they all get a lot of love as being some of the greatest announced tandems in wrestling history, and deservedly so. And one that, in my opinion, ranks up there, maybe in the top three, along with those other two, are Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura. They just played very well off each other. I don't think Vince McMahon gets enough credit for being a good announcer. You know, granted, he couldn't call, you know, a wrestling hold for his life, but it didn't matter, because Vince had a certain cadence, he had a certain passion for the product, being that it was his product. He was very good at what he did, and Jesse didn't care. Jesse would insult him, he would insult, you know, anybody that he felt was being an idiot, and they just worked very well off each other. So in this particular episode of Raw, Jesse said he wanted to relive the old days, and he actually had Vince McMahon come on down, dressed up as he used to be. He wasn't wearing the old, you know, blue three-piece suit that he used to wear, but out comes Mr. McMahon wearing the tuxedo with the bow tie, dressed to the nines, coming down to the old Saturday Night's Main Event theme music, Obsession by Animotion, which was a big song back in the 80s, and that was the original theme music for the old Saturday Night's Main Event. Probably the reason why nobody in the audience was reacting to it, because you have an audience full of people that have absolutely no idea that that was the original music for that show many years ago. So Vince comes down to the ring, puts the headset on, and what we got was a treat for longtime fans, because Vince and Jesse took the time to call a battle royal on this night. It was a battle royal to determine the number one contender, as I recall, for the WWE Championship. It was a battle royal that Sheamus actually went on to win. I believe that victory gave Sheamus the title shot against John Cena in the tables match at the December pay-per-view back in 09. Unless my timeline is messed up here, that was Sheamus' first title win in WWE. So on this night, it was Vince and Jesse together for the first time in probably since 1990, now that I think about it, was the last time they called a show together, calling a battle royal, and it was just like old times. You know, Vince's voice has grown a bit more grovelly over the years, and Jesse, to me, sounded the same. You know, they played off each other very well. It was interesting to hear Vince calling, or attempting, I should say, to call moves, and, you know, this person was almost eliminated in kind of near falls and stuff like that, and course, Jesse got his old classic line in there, "Shut up, McMahon." And it was just a nice throwback for longtime fans. I mean, there's probably a lot of people who weren't around back then or who weren't fans of the product back in the day who probably looked at this and went, "What's the big deal? Why is this on your top 30 Raw moments list?" But in terms of nostalgia and something that I never thought I'd have an opportunity to see or hear again, this was a refreshing change of pace, and it was one of my favorite moments from any of these guest-hosted editions of Raw that they've done. Again, there's a few good ones out there. Bob Barker, I mentioned before, was a great Raw guest host, and there have been a few other ones, I'm sure. But hearing Vince and Jesse announce the Battle Royal on Raw that night, just like it was old times, and of course, Jesse getting really irritated at Vince because he perceived that Vince was making a slight at him and he was a Vietnam veteran and how dare you insult me. And Jesse, of course, went on a political rant, and as he is known to do. It was just a great moment for old-time fans, and one that I will never forget. Number 29 was a moment that took place on the go-home edition of Raw, 6 days before WrestleMania 23. Back in 2007, March 26th was the date, and it was in Chicago. It was the announcement of Jim Ross going into the WWE Hall of Fame. I believe JR was the final inductee to be announced as part of the class of 2007, a well-deserved induction into the Hall of Fame, perhaps long overdue, some might argue. And on this night, they aired a special video package, a tribute of sorts to Jim Ross with a bunch of people, including Triple H and Steve Austin. I think even Vince McMahon may have been in the video, basically talking about how JR is the greatest of all time at his craft. And I believe as part of the video, Triple H even said he made a mention of Gordon Solie, and obviously Gordon Solie was great and was an inspiration and a mentor of sorts to Jim Ross himself. But Triple H said, you know, he'll look JR in the eye and call him the greatest of all time. And it's hard to find another wrestling announcer with the kind of passion and the kind of talent that Jim Ross had. You know, that's the reason people look at him as being certainly among the best of all time. I think he is the best wrestling announcer of all time. And on this night, he got his just rewards. And he was, I believe he was caught off guard. Now, I'm not sure how far in advance Ross may have known about the Hall of Fame induction. I don't believe that when they went on the air that night, he was unaware of it. It's possible. I think it's just as likely he was told maybe a few hours before or the day of the Raw taping, but I think he may have had some knowledge of it. But regardless, he has talked about the reaction that he got in Chicago that night. Now, you might be saying, okay, he was announced for the Hall of Fame, big deal. But you go back on YouTube or wherever and you find video of the moment when the video aired and they went back live to the arena. And they showed Jim Ross, and he stood up and took a bow. And the reaction that he got from the fans in Chicago that night. And while this is all going on, they have that kind of that special Hall of Fame music playing in the background throughout the entire thing, which only added to the moment, in my opinion. It was a touching moment. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. It was a touching moment. It came at a time when, you know, Jim Ross has obviously been disrespected a lot by Vince McMahon and made fun of. And has had his fair share of embarrassing moments on television. And he's been removed from the announce booth, then brought back and removed, then announced. He's had a litany of health issues, attacks of Bell's palsy. For as great a career as he has had, he's had a lot of pretty low moments. And to me, this is maybe his finest moment. And I think he's even commented on this before, how much that meant to him. He was legitimately moved by it. There were tears in his eyes. He was wiping them away. He got a reaction that night that caught a lot of people behind the scenes by surprise. Vince and other people, they did not expect him to get that sort of reaction that he got from the fans in Chicago that night. And it opened up a lot of eyes. I don't really recall what the announcing situation was immediately after this. There may have been talk of removing him at that point, but I think this may have temporarily kind of postponed it. I don't really remember when it was that Ross was removed from commentary after this, how long after this it may have been, but I believe he may have gotten a stay of execution, so to speak, because the reaction was so strong. It was really a very moving moment. I think the music in the background certainly added to it, but in going back, you know, again, we're talking about the top 30 Raw moments here, and this was one of those moments that really does make you emotional when you go back and watch it, because here's a guy who is perhaps the greatest of all time at his craft, getting the kind of recognition that he deserves. A rare moment on Raw over the last decade where Jim Ross actually gets this sort of respect without, you know, having to kiss somebody's ass at the end of the show or something like that. And it was really a touching moment, and a moment that JR himself to this day talks about as among the greatest moments of his career. So, in my opinion, it's a well-deserved moment on any list that you're going to put together, quite frankly, of top moments in Monday Night Raw history. The night that Jim Ross was announced for the Hall of Fame and got quite the reception from the fans in Chicago. Number 28 was one of the more memorable moments from the so-called Attitude Era. The old days of the Raw is War show. And Raw was in its Raw is War phase. There was a lot of fun stuff that happened during that time period. And that was also, I think, the real peak of creativity for D-Generation X as a faction. They were doing a lot of different things. In fact, they show up on this countdown list a second time here, a little bit further down the list. But this particular moment was from the July 6, 1998 edition of Raw. At the time, DX was engaged in a rivalry with The Nation. There was a lot of faction warfare going on back during that time period in WWE. And so on this particular edition of Raw, the members of DX, that being Triple H and the New Age Outlaws and X-Pac and a relative unknown by the name of Jason Sensation, who had a brief run in WWE and was known for his spot-on impersonations of a lot of different wrestlers. They all came out to do their own impersonation of The Nation. The Nation, of course, was led at the time by The Rock. You had Mark Henry, D'Lo Brown, comma. I think by that point, Farouk had already been excommunicated from The Nation faction. And this is notable because it was legitimately funny. It was a laugh-out-loud funny segment. You know, WWE over the years has been hit or miss when it comes to their comedy. Unfortunately, over the last several years, it's been more miss than hit. This segment was a hit. You had Triple H coming out there dressed up as The Rock. Of course, he called himself The Croc, wearing kind of a faux version of one of The Rock's $500, you know, button-down shirts. And you had X-Pac out there with the big padding that said Mizark on it, making fun of the world's strongest man, Mark Henry. You had the Road Dog out there dressed up as D'Lo Brown, calling himself B-Lo, if I recall correctly. I believe Billy Gunn was out there dressed up as Kama, who of course would go on in later years to be the Godfather. Jason Sensation was out there with a fake big nose and seemingly wearing a road crossing sign. He was dressed up as Owen Hart. China was out there as well. I honestly don't remember who she was dressed up as. Obviously, it wasn't a female, I don't think, because The Nation didn't have a female member. But nevertheless, she was kind of in the background anyway. It didn't really matter. But the interplay between these guys was just great. And, you know, Road Dogg coming over there and repeating what everybody was saying and, you know, jumping up to the top rope and bobbing his head back and forth like D'Lo Brown used to do. And, you know, Jason Sensation's impersonation of Owen, again, was just dead on. He did the Owen Hart voice to the point where if I would have closed my eyes, I could have envisioned that it was actually Owen Hart saying those things. You know, Triple H, of course, talking about, you know, The Rock just came from the bathroom and you should have smelled what The Rock was cooking. And all these different things. It was just, it was great. And, of course, there was that other classic remark when Triple H looked at X-Pac, who, of course, was dressed up as Mark Henry and pointed at the padding and said, you know, The Rock, you know, The Rock has a great physique here, but Mark, you know, I got a question for you. How is it that you can get your pecs to go all the way around to your back like that? And I got to be honest with you, to this day, I still don't quite understand what that means. I'm not ashamed to say it. I never got that joke, but everybody seemed to think it was a pretty good one. So this segment was great. It was just very well done. It was comedy done right on Raw, which, again, you don't see too often these days. But DX, when they were on their A game back then, they were as funny as anybody. And this was, you know, in terms of impersonations, we've seen a lot of that over the years as well. The more modern incarnation of DX back in 07 did something similar to the McMahons, where they kind of impersonated Vince and Shane. And that was amusing. But the original impersonation from DX back in the day when they impersonated The Nation is still, to me, the best version of any impersonation I've seen on WWE television, and it's still funny even today when you go back and watch it. Number 27 was kind of a sad moment from the April 11th, 2011 edition of Raw, shortly after WrestleMania 27. It was the announcement of Edge's retirement. And Edge came out on Raw that night. He was the World Heavyweight Champion at the time. He had retained the title at WrestleMania in the opening match against Alberto Del Rio, and subsequently had undergone some exams. He was having some issues with his neck and I think some numbness. Of course, Edge had underwent spinal fusion surgery many years earlier, the same surgery that wrestlers like Steve Austin and Lita, Rhino, Chris Benoit, and others had undergone. And so, unfortunately, the end result of this was that his spinal stenosis was such that WWE told him that he was done. The decision was made for him. They would not clear him to wrestle. His condition was too risky. It was, as Edge has said in many interviews, and I believe he spoke with us about it as well, when myself, Noah Mark, and Brian Blade interviewed him as part of Fan Access or WrestleMania this year in Miami. The decision was easy because it was made for him. It was not something that he wanted. He wanted to go out on his own terms, and unfortunately, he did not have the chance to do that. So in this particular episode of Raw, he came out there, not really as Edge, more so as Adam Copeland, and made the announcement that his career was over and he was retiring. And I remember watching this segment and thinking, you know, this was a very heartfelt interview. This was very good, but I didn't buy it. Deep down inside, I didn't buy it. Maybe I didn't want to buy it. Because we've seen so many speeches on wrestling TV shows over the years of people announcing their retirement that after a while you just, no pun intended, you become numb to it. Because you just think, okay, it's a setup for an angle. You know, there were rumors at the time that Edge was going to be feuding with Christian. Christian might turn heel and they'll be able to feud for the World Heavyweight title. And I believe that was the direction they were going to go in. Of course, what ended up happening was Christian did become the beneficiary of Edge's injury. Unfortunately, he won the world title, lost it to Randy Orton, and went on to have probably the feud of the year with Orton in 2011. But of course, we found out this was no angle. This was legit. He came out on SmackDown. They had a whole big tribute for him. He did another speech. He was very emotional about it. It can't be an easy thing to be told that your career is over. You know, at 38 years of age, still relatively young. I mean, in terms of wrestling years, obviously he's a bit older than most, but it can't be an easy thing to be told, to have that decision made for you. And I know Edge just said he was about a year or two away anyway from calling it quits, but everybody says that. I still remember when Booker T had just turned 40. He was 40 or 41, and he had done interviews around that time period saying, you know, I've had a lot of problems with my knees and stuff, and I can't see myself going more than another 2 or 3 years. And of course, Booker T went on to wrestle for a hell of a lot more than 2 or 3 years. And he's just one example of many. So my memory of this is that I just didn't believe it at first. And when it became clear that it was legit, I kind of felt bad, but not really, only because, again, I think most of us have been conditioned to think that when a wrestler goes on TV, especially when they're the champion, for crying out loud, claiming that because of an injury or whatever the case may be, that they were going to retire, your first instinct is to say, okay, BS. You know, he'll be back in 3 months or 6 months. He's taking a vacation, whatever the case may be. And that was not to be. It was not the case. And this was about as heartfelt a retirement speech as you're ever going to see on Monday Night Raw. Certainly a sad moment, but in a lot of ways, you know, I think it was also a pretty cool moment that he got to go out there and thank the people he wanted to thank, and just really, he poured his heart out. You know, he poured his heart out to the fans, and he got to go out on top, which a lot of guys don't have a chance to do. I mean, honestly, how many people have an opportunity in WWE, no less, okay, the biggest company in the world, to be the World Heavyweight Champion, to win at WrestleMania, to be the world champion, and to retire, and to go out on top the way that he did? If there's any solace in that whole situation, I would think that that's probably it. And so that's on the list here at number 27, because it would be hard to not, I think, include something like this on the list. Edge was a big, big part of WWE. He was a big-time tag team wrestler. He went on to become one of the biggest single stars in company history. I think an 11-time world champion. Had a lot of success. A lot of that success came on Raw over the years. A lot of it came on SmackDown, too, because he carried that brand for quite a while. But Edge was a big part of the fabric of that company, and his retirement came also at a time when, quite frankly, and this is still true, I think, to this day, the company is very thin on main event level talent. So the company took quite a hit, I think, with Edge's retirement as well at the time. They really could, and still, could use somebody like him in the main event picture. So this was a big moment in Raw history. I just feel like a lot of us, myself included, didn't quite realize how big at the time that it happened. Number 26 on the countdown is the wedding of Test and Stephanie McMahon, or at least what was supposed to be the wedding of Test and Stephanie. Back on Raw, it was November 29th, 1999. At the time, Triple H had been feuding with the McMahon family, and in particular, Vince McMahon, who was a babyface during this period, for those of you keeping track of all the babyface heel turns he's had over the years. And this was Triple H's way of kind of getting back at Vince McMahon. And boy, did he get back at Vince McMahon. And what was going to be a very special evening, they had the male and female artist who did the wedding song for the Macho Man, Randy Savage, and Elizabeth for their wedding back at SummerSlam 91. They came out on stage and sang their rendition of the song together, which is a great song, by the way. And Vince was out there. Linda was out there. I think Shane may have been there. I don't remember. And what ended up happening, of course, we all know, Triple H interrupted the ceremony, directed everybody's attention to the Titantron, and showed us a video that had been recorded earlier in the day of Triple H driving to the little, I forgot what exactly the name was, it was the Little White Chapel of Love or something like that. They had the little naked babies above it and everything, and Triple H drove up. It was like a drive-thru. It was like going through McDonald's. It was a McDonald's speed wedding here. And Stephanie was passed out in the passenger seat because somebody, if I remember correctly, had spiked her drink at the bachelorette party. Of course, this was all part of Triple H's master plan. And Triple H spoke for Stephanie, spoke for himself, said, "I do." They did the presentation of the rings. It was all kind of funny. And they drove off into the night. And as it were, Triple H and Stephanie were officially married. Now, of course, the significance of this, we've seen many weddings and attempted weddings on WWE television. Of course, if there's ever a wedding on WWE TV, probably not a good idea to be around there unless you want to be part of some of the mayhem that normally ensues. And I mentioned the Triple H, Randy Savage Elizabeth wedding before. That wedding actually did go off without a hitch, except at the after party, you may recall, there was a cobra that jumped up out of one of the gift boxes when Elizabeth was going through the presents. And that, of course, was planted by Jake the Snake Roberts, and The Undertaker also was there. And so, even then, there was bad things that occurred to the people involved. So the same was the case here. Poor Test, he got jilted. He was the jilted groom. He never did get to marry Stephanie. Stephanie ended up going heel, aligned with Triple H. The significance of this is that these two are actually legitimately married today, and will control the company one day, but in a lot of ways, they're already controlling the company in some ways. Vince, of course, is still around. He is the head cheese. He calls the shots, but Triple H and Stephanie are going to inherit the whole thing when Vince is out of the picture. And were it not for this angle, that may not be the case. It's an interesting what-if question. Where would somebody like Triple H be today were it not for this angle? You know, would Shane McMahon still be in WWE? Would Shane McMahon be the heir to the throne, as many people thought he would be once upon a time? There's no real way of knowing that, of course, but it was through this angle that Triple H and Stephanie started to intimately work together and developed whatever feelings of affection they had for each other, and it really did change the course of wrestling history. That's not hyperbole, that's the truth. It changed the course, certainly, of WWE history. And as WWE goes, for better or worse, so goes the wrestling business. So, for all intents and purposes, it really did change the course of wrestling history. For Test, unfortunately, Test never really did reach the heights that he had attained in 99. I've said on my podcast before that one of my favorite SummerSlam matches from over the years involved Test. It was the Love Her or Leave Her match between Test and Shane McMahon at SummerSlam 99. You know, when Shane was fighting for fighting for his sister's honor, wasn't really fond of Test, and I think it was that match that, you know, kind of united the family together, and they had a hell of a match at that pay-per-view. To me, I mean, that was the coming out party, so to speak, for Test, to show that he can really have a match on the big stage like that. The people were behind him. He was really, really over. And it looked like Test, who had the size that, you know, Vince McMahon liked. I mean, he could have been pushed as a world champion, no doubt. And it was after this that Test's push essentially came to an end. Because he really didn't do much after this. You know, they didn't even really push a big feud. You would think there was a ready-made feud there that they could have gotten some pay-per-view matches out of between him and Triple H. And they didn't even really go in that direction. You know, Triple H had the match with Vince, and then he moved on to having those great matches with Mick Foley and you know, being the world champion and all that. So Test's career kind of, I don't want to say that it hit the skids, because it kind of did. I mean, he, you know, he did some other things, but he never really regained the level of stardom that he had in 1999. I figured he was going to go all the way to the top, and he never did. And that's a shame. Of course, Test now is dead. He's no longer with us. So the same can be said for Test. You know, had they gone all the way with him in 99, would he still be here today? I mean, who knows? You know, there's really, again, no way of knowing. But this segment is a significant segment in wrestling history for all the obvious reasons. You can't do a top Raw countdown without including the wedding. Well, what was supposed to be the wedding of Test and Stephanie, but really was the first wedding of Triple H and Stephanie, who today, of course, are the true power couple behind the scenes in WWE. Number 25 on the list was a sad but fitting moment in the history of Monday Night Raw. It was the final WWE appearance, at least until WrestleMania X7, of Bobby the Brain Heenan, the greatest wrestling manager of all time, and one of the greatest commentators of all time as well. And on this particular night, Heenan, of course, was the announcer on Raw with Vince McMahon, and he had a love-hate, mostly hate relationship with the late Gorilla Monsoon. Monsoon and Heenan, in my opinion, the greatest wrestling announced duo of all time. They were the Abbott and Costello of the WWF. They played off each other perfectly. Nobody since then has had the kind of chemistry that they've had. Not just as announcers. I mean, they would do a lot of different things back in the day. They did comedy skits on the old primetime wrestling show. So you can say that, you know, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, for example, had great chemistry, but they didn't have chemistry the way that Monsoon and Heenan had chemistry. And on this particular evening, Monsoon was, I don't think Monsoon was on the show until the end, but throughout the night, Heenan was making a lot of wisecracks at his expense, you know, calling him the big gorilla, he's probably out having a banana, whatever it was that he was saying about him. And Monsoon at the time was the, I believe, was he the president at that time? He might have been the president of the WWF at the time. I know he was president in 96. Maybe he was president as early as 93. Obviously, he had some power. And at the end of the show, Monsoon unexpectedly showed up. And Heenan saw this, and he's like, oh, look, it's the gorilla. It's the big gorilla. And Monsoon goes over to the announce table, and he kind of leans over, and he's talking to Bobby, and Bobby's trying to be all nice and cordial to him. And ultimately, what happened is Monsoon grabbed Heenan, escorted him out of the Manhattan Center, and physically threw him out of the building, threw him and his belongings out of the building. And, you know, the scene of, you know, Bobby's bag laying on the floor, and there's a roll of toilet paper. And Vince McMahon on commentary, by the way, his subtle little bits of commentary was great here also, because, you know, he was looking at this, he was going, you know, Bobby Heenan, a roll of toilet paper, a sock, you know, a sock had fallen out of his bag. And, you know, Bobby Heenan, the character Bobby Heenan, was one of the most unlikable characters at the time in WWF history. You know, he had managed all the big-time heels. He had nothing nice to say about anybody. He was one of the most selfish people you'll ever find. He even mistreated his own wrestlers. And yet, Heenan was so awesome at being Bobby Heenan. You couldn't just help but like the guy. And I felt I just watched that on YouTube, you know, in putting this countdown together. I watched it again recently for the first time in a while. And it really did bring a tear to my eye, because Bobby Heenan is one of my all-time favorites. And this was his last hurrah in WWF. I'm not even really so sure he wanted to leave. The reason he left and went to WCW, I think, was more he had a really bad neck. And I believe he needed surgery on his neck, and it might have been an insurance issue, and it was just not something WWF could do for him. So he went to WCW, and I believe it was in large part because of his neck. So this was a very sad goodbye, because at the end of the show, when Bobby collects himself, right before he goes to walk off, and they show that final shot of him walking off in the night, he kind of salutes. He does the little salute. And that was his way of saying goodbye. And there were tears streaming. You know, you could tell his eyes were all watery. It was a really, really emotional moment. But it was quite fitting that if Bobby Heenan was literally physically going to be thrown out of the WWF, of all the people to do it, it had to be Gorilla Monsoon. After all the years of bickering back and forth and Gorilla, you know, teasing, you know, if you don't stop, I'm going to have you thrown out of here. He finally did. So the way they worked it was almost ingenious. It was so sad to see Bobby go. He was obviously very sad. I'm sure Gorilla and everybody were legitimately very sad. But the way that they did it was perfect. If it had to happen, it happened perfectly. And it was Bobby's, again, final night until he appeared for that gimmick battle royal at WrestleMania 17. And really, that was... He might have also done another backstage comedy skit, if I remember, with Mean Gene and Moolah and Mae Young, possibly on the same show. I don't really remember. But that was it. That was really, as far as I'm concerned, his last true appearance on Monday Night Raw. And it was quite sad, but yet quite fitting all at the same time. Number 24... DX invades WCW. Actually, they did multiple times. A couple weeks after this, they actually went down to their headquarters in Atlanta. But on the April 27th, 1998 edition of Raw, DX took it to WCW at the arena. They were at the Norfolk Scope, I believe, in Norfolk, Virginia. And commandeering a tank, DX rode down the streets towards the building and actually literally tried to get into the arena where WCW Monday Nitro was taking place at the time, or was to have taken place that evening. I don't remember. It was daylight outside, so I don't know if the actual show was ongoing at that point or not. But just the sight of DX riding down the street in a tank, trying to get into the building. You know, at the time, there was a fierce war going on, the Monday Night Wars, WWF, WCW. And they were firing a shot over at WCW. They went out, got, you know, in the middle of all the fans and had people chanting WCW sucks. And they were, you know, getting people to admit that they had gotten their tickets for free. And, of course, just as they were about to get into the back of the building, Eric Bischoff had ordered that the gate be closed. And there you see the gate being lowered and lowered and lowered. And, if I were Eric Bischoff, hell, I would have let them in. And rounded up a whole bunch of WCW guys to kind of stand there and just beat the shit out of them, but that's just me. Who knows what would have happened if they would have actually gotten into the building that night. That would have been very interesting, but nonetheless, it was a pretty brazen move on their part, and it was fun. You know, it was part of the fun back then. You had these two companies that were at each other's throats. They were warring back and forth each and every week, and you never knew who was going to jump ship or what was going to happen. And to actually see these guys commandeering a tank, nearly riding into the building, it was funny, it was cool, it was something we had never seen before, nor will we ever see again, most likely. And it was certainly a memorable Raw moment, one that, if you saw it at the time, it's certainly not something you're ever going to forget. That image is pretty hard to get out of your mind. Number 23 on the countdown is from the January 22nd, 1996 edition of Monday Night Raw. It was an incident that we would see a lot of incarnations of this on Raw over the years. Nitro, too. Examples of authority figures getting physically beaten up. You know, back in the day, it was almost unheard of. And when it would happen, it would be a big deal to see the president or, you know, in the case of a Vince McMahon getting, you know, stunnered for the first time, the actual chairman of the company being physically assaulted. It was the sort of thing that would kind of make your jaw drop because it's not something you saw all the time back then. And, you know, a couple months after this, we saw Eric Bischoff get powerbombed at a pay-per-view off the stage by the Outsiders, and that was a big deal. And, the following year, of course, it became commonplace to see Steve Austin beating up Vince McMahon and kind of embarrassing him in front of the world. But this was something that we had not really seen before. And on this show, it was the Monday Night Raw debut of the man they call Vader. He had made his WWF debut the night before at the Royal Rumble pay-per-view. He was eliminated by Shawn Michaels, came back in the ring, beat up Shawn Michaels, and caused a lot of chaos, basically. And he may have also assaulted some referees, I don't really remember. But on this show, Vader did assault a referee. And that brought out the then-president of the WWF, Gorilla Monsoon, who I just talked about a few moments ago. And Monsoon tried to kind of intercede here, and Vader got physical with Monsoon, and Monsoon is a former wrestler. He's not going to take shit from anybody. He pushed back, and that was probably a mistake on his part. He got a little overzealous, and Vader squashed him in the corner and proceeded to assault the president of the WWF and finished off Monsoon with a Vader bomb. And not even Vader's manager at the time, Jim Cornette, could control him. He tried to, but even Cornette got shoved over by Vader. This is when Vader was being booked as a monster, as he should have been. Early on in his WWF run, he was booked very well, because Vader was a monster. That's how you book somebody like him. Unfortunately, he never got that big run with the title. At one point, he was scheduled to win the WWF Championship from Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam. That did not happen. Shawn ended up beating him. And from there, in a lot of ways, it was kind of downhill for Vader. He never really was a main event player in WWF after that. But when he first came in, he certainly was booked to be an indestructible force, and Gorilla Monsoon felt his wrath on this particular night. If they did an angle like this today, I don't know that it would really be a big deal at all. I mean, we see somebody like John Laurinaitis get beat up, and it's like, who cares? But this was a big deal back then, especially to me as a younger Raw viewer watching this, you know, to see poor Gorilla Monsoon, who, you know, was also a beloved figure in the WWF at the time. You know, you had a personal attachment to Monsoon. He was one of those authority figures. You would still get booed when he was introduced because that was the cool thing to do at the time. You booed the head guy. You booed Jack Tunney when he was president. You boo Gorilla Monsoon because he's the president as well. But he was still a beloved figure. You had a personal attachment. You knew who he was. He had a lot of affection for the guy, and to see him get beaten up like that by Vader was something that, you know, it brought out a lot of emotion in you as a viewer. You didn't like seeing this happen, and it was definitely a moment in Raw history. Vader, I think, was indefinitely suspended as a result of that. I don't remember how long he may have been off television for. I know he was at WrestleMania that year in a six-man tag on the show. But Vader's assault on Gorilla Monsoon, one of the earliest examples of something like that that I could think of on Monday Night Raw, and certainly left an impact. Number 22 on the countdown was the return of the Great One, The Rock, making his Raw return for the first time in 7 years on the Valentine's Day edition of Raw, February 14th, 2011. Of course, this was the night that The Rock came back. He was announced as the guest host for WrestleMania 27, a WrestleMania that did big business in large part because The Rock was on the show, even though he wasn't wrestling. And to me, that's still one of the worst WrestleMania main events of all time with John Cena and The Miz. But seeing The Rock back on Raw for the first time in 7 years was a big deal. And he came out, he got a hero's welcome from the fans. Last time he had been on the show was back in 2004. He was actually on the show, I think, at least twice that year. Once I know he came out to help Eugene in a segment that involved Jonathan Coachman. And La Resistance also may have come out to beat on The Rock. But I'm not sure if that was actually his last one. He may have had another one where he came out, he did some comedy with Tajiri and stuff like that. But it had been a long, long, long time since Rock was on Raw. A lot had gone down. There was some animosity between Rock and WWE back at the end of 04, as a matter of fact. His contract with the company had been allowed to expire. They didn't approach him about renewing it or anything like that. It just kind of lapsed. And he took that to be a slap in the face. The company claimed it was a clerical oversight, but give me a freaking break. I mean, you know, The Rock is one of the biggest stars in the history of that company. You don't allow his contract to expire as a result of a, quote, clerical oversight. That just doesn't happen. I don't know what the issues may have been between the two sides at the time, but Rock didn't take too kindly to that. And he let WWE kind of, you know, slip away from him. It was a part of his life that was over. He went on. He invested himself in his movies. Never stopped following wrestling. He's always been a fan and continued to follow the product. And probably some TNA as well. And he did make amends with the company long before 2011. It's not like they were, you know, bad blood between the two sides for a full 7 years. But it took that long to get him back on TV. Because The Rock's career in Hollywood really did take off. You know, I think now he's number three or number four on the list of the highest paid male actors in Hollywood. That's a big deal. But he came to an agreement. Vince McMahon, when he wants to make a deal happen, when he wants to do business the right way, Vince McMahon will do business. It doesn't matter if, you know, you've called him names before, if there's been bad blood. I mean, look at the list of people that he has brought back over the years, from Hulk Hogan to everybody in between, Roddy Piper, Hulk Hogan, Bret Hart. Believe me, when Vince wants to do business, if there's money to be made, more often than not, he'll do it. And so The Rock was introduced on this show, like I said, huge reaction from the crowd that night, and made a very bold claim on that show, saying that, you know, he took his glasses off, he said he was talking from the heart as Dwayne and not The Rock, that he was back for good. And I mean, I took that to mean what I figured it would mean, which is that you're not going to see Rock on Raw every single week, but he was back in the fold. He was back in the family, and he would be making more appearances as opposed to letting 7 years go by before you see him on TV again. And so that was The Rock's first appearance back And really was also the kickoff in a lot of ways to his feud with John Cena, because that night he started making cracks at John Cena's expense. They kind of built it up a lot. In a lot of ways, they built up the heat between Cena and Rock more so than Cena and Miz, even though that was the WrestleMania main event. And it was another year before Rock and Cena actually hooked horns in the WrestleMania main event. But in terms of big comebacks and big returns in the history of Monday Night Raw, this was certainly way up there near the top of the list, if not at the top of the list. From the reaction it got, The Rock, of course, one of the biggest stars in company history, and letting that long a period of time go by with, you know, with no appearances whatsoever. I know Rock taped something for... he did tape a little something for the Vince-Donald Trump feud, a little video something, so that's... That to me, doesn't really count, but there was that. But he got a hell of a reaction from the crowd. It was good to see The Rock back. I think Rock being back has been good for WWE's business. Obviously, they did big business again this year with WrestleMania, in large part because of that Rock-Cena match. And one of the best returns you'll ever see. He certainly seemed to surprise a lot of people when he walked out on stage that night. I was not among them. I had kind of guessed that Rock would be the special guest that Vince McMahon had teased on the show the week before. But it was a hell of a comeback. He got a hell of a response from the crowd. You could tell it really did touch him, because you know, you're away from the ring for that long. You have a lot of younger viewers and newer viewers. You never really know what kind of reaction you're going to get, or if people are going to resent you and call you a sellout. And that was certainly not the case on Raw this night. Speaking of big returns, number 21 on the countdown, the return of the game, Triple H, returning from his first quadricep injury on the January 7th, 2002 edition of Monday Night Raw from Madison Square Garden in New York City. The last time we had seen Triple H on television, he was part of the two-man power trip, the big heel act with Stone Cold Steve Austin. They were managed by Vince McMahon, and they had been tag team champions. Triple H was the Intercontinental Champion. He had lost the Intercontinental title to Kane. And the very next night on Raw, he and Austin had lost their tag team titles in one of the greatest matches in the history of Raw to Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit, which is a shame. One of the greatest matches in the history of Raw that you'll never see again because of you-know-who. But it was during that match that Triple H unfortunately tore his quad. He was it was a freak thing. He planted his foot wrong when he was going to break up a Walls of Jericho by Chris Jericho, and he basically tore the, I think he tore the muscle right off the bone. It was a pretty severe injury. He continued to compete for another 2 or 3 minutes to finish the match, and it took him 8 months to recover from an injury that, there are athletes, there are football players who never come back from an injury like that. And Triple H, I give him a lot of credit. He went through the rehabilitation, everything he had to do. He came back quite literally bigger and stronger than he was the last time we saw him. And I'll let you fill in the blanks on that one there. He looked like a monster when he came back. Just enormous. And he got an enormous reaction from the crowd at Madison Square Garden that night. Jim Ross made mention on commentary that it was one of the loudest roars he had ever heard in the history of Madison Square Garden. And I don't know if that's true, because there's been a hell of a lot of historic sporting events, non-wrestling events, boxing events, basketball games, and that sort of thing at Madison Square Garden. I'm sure that have gotten quite the reaction. But this was a hell of a response. And, you know, Triple H on one of his old DVD sets made the comment that he was very nervous. He didn't know what kind of reaction he was going to get when he came out, which I can believe. You know, he was a heel the last time we saw him, and it would have been perfectly understandable for him to come out and for people to boo him, because he had been booked as a pretty dastardly heel who beat people up with sledgehammers the last time we saw him. But, you know, he talked about, I didn't know if there were going to be crickets and, you know, total silence when I came out. That's complete bullshit. Give me a break. He knew exactly the kind of response he was going to get when he came out, as far as I'm concerned. And he got a hero's welcome. I had talked about The Rock a few moments ago when he came back just last year. And this was a similar kind of comeback for Triple H. He was beloved in the building that night. They say absence makes the heart grow fonder. And this was a great example of that. Triple H had been gone for so long, it's hard to believe that the whole invasion angle, Triple H missed the entire thing. He was not part of it at all. And that was one of the bigger angles in the history of the company. So he had missed all of that. He had been out of the public eye and really had not been heard from much, if at all, during that whole time period. Came back, announced that he was going to be entering himself into the Royal Rumble. Then, of course, Kurt Angle came out, and Triple H left him laying. But in terms of just a response, a roar from the crowd. I was not, unfortunately, in the Garden that night. I wish I had been. It's one of those moments that you just wish you could be there live to be part of it. You know you're getting a hell of a reaction from a crowd when they have to loop your music. When your music runs and runs and runs and they have to loop it over again. So that was a pretty cool moment for Triple H. Unfortunately, not the first time he would hurt one of his quads. I don't remember his second return being quite as memorable as his first. But you know what they say, you always remember your first. And that was certainly true of Triple H's comeback back in 2002. Number 20 on the countdown is a Money in the Bank cash-in. It's from Raw on June 30th, 2008 from Oklahoma City. Edge was the World Heavyweight Champion at the time. He had come out flanked by his edgeheads, Curt Hawkins and Zack Ryder, to interrupt Jim Ross's farewell speech. If I remember correctly, Jim Ross was in his hometown of Oklahoma City, and he had just been drafted over to SmackDown. Wasn't too happy about that. And so Edge came out to kind of rain on his parade. JR got escorted away, and Edge cut a promo talking about how Raw didn't even have a world champion. Things were kind of in disarray after the recent draft, and boasted that, you know, I'm the world champion, and that really was what his speech was all about, just gloating. And Edge went to leave. Batista's music hit. He was in a feud with Batista at the time, and Batista came out, attacked Edge. This was one of those spontaneous brawls at the beginning of Raw that we really weren't accustomed to seeing at the time, so I think it really had a lot of impact because of that. I mean, you saw things like this. This was commonplace back during the Attitude Era, the Monday Night Wars, Raw, Nitro, and all that kind of stuff. It just felt impromptu. It wasn't just your typical, you know, opening show promo or just an opening show match. So Batista beat up Edge. He laid him out with a Batista bomb. Went to go walk to the back when CM Punk's music hit. And CM Punk came out with a referee, ran into the ring, cashed in his Money in the Bank briefcase. The referee rang the bell. As soon as Edge got to his feet, Punk put him on his shoulders. GTS, 1-2-3. And just like that, CM Punk had brought the World Heavyweight Championship over to Raw, won his first World Championship, unless you count the ECW title, which most people don't. It was a big moment in the career of CM Punk. His first world title, the place went nuts. He was celebrating, he was sliding all over the ring and holding the title up and screaming and shouting, and it was a great moment. I half expected him to lose the title by the end of the night. Thankfully, that did not happen. Although they didn't really do much with him during that first title reign. But again, it was one of those unpredictable moments on Raw. Great reaction from the crowd. It made for a really, really cool moment. I don't know that people really thought that Punk would even win the championship. Maybe people thought that he would have been the first one to cash in and not get it because Punk didn't have that look. You know, he was small and he had tattoos, and there were a lot of people who wanted him to fail backstage in WWE at the time. There were a lot of people against him, and to see him win the world title on Raw was a special moment. And obviously, looking at where Punk is today, he's been WWE champion now for about 8 months, and next to John Cena is probably the biggest star in the company. It's pretty cool to see the evolution of the career of CM Punk, and it really goes all the way back to this first Money in the Bank cash-in when he became the world champion for the very first time. Number 19 on the list is one of the more iconic moments in the history of Monday Night Raw. It took place on the Go Home Show to WrestleMania 15, March 22nd, 1999. It was the infamous beer truck incident. At the time, Steve Austin was going for the WWF Championship at WrestleMania against The Rock. It was The Rock, Shane McMahon, and Vince McMahon in the ring together, cutting a promo when the glass shattered, and out came Austin, who drove down to the ring. Actually, I think it was somebody else doing the driving, because you could see somebody in the passenger seat. And they nearly took the Titantron out as well. They almost knocked the damn thing down. Drove down to the ring in the beer truck. Austin got out, climbed on top of that truck. The place was going apeshit. This was Austin at his peak. I mean, he could do no wrong. Everything that guy touched back then turned to gold. Or beer, as it were. And Austin proceeded to cut a promo on The Rock, a great go-home promo, by the way, for their WrestleMania main event. He talked about rolling into Route 316 and, you know, burning down the SmackDown hotel, and told Rock he needed to get his ass serious because he was going to take the title from him at WrestleMania. So as Rock goes to retort, Austin, of course, is pulling down the hose from the side of the truck and proceeds to unleash an unholy amount of beer on the McMahons and The Rock in the ring, giving them the proverbial beer bath, and not only them, but probably the people in the first 10 rows, I would say. probably were doused in beer. Sucks if you were one of those people that had a digital camera out at the time. Thankfully, there were no iPhones back then, which easily would have been destroyed by the deluge of beer. But it was certainly a fun moment. People were enjoying themselves, probably getting some getting a free beverage if you were sitting in the first few rows. It was just chaos and pandemonium. It was one of those things that you've never seen before, and you never knew what Steve Austin was going to do when he came out. You never knew which vehicle he was going to destroy. You never knew which vehicle he was going to ride out in, whether it was going to be a Zamboni or a bus or a monster truck or, you know, God knows what. And it was one of those special moments that you know is special when somebody tries to recreate it, which is exactly what they tried to do 2 years later with Kurt Angle during the Alliance invasion angle, when they had Kurt Angle ride out there in the milk truck, which I thought was kind of cute just because it fit Kurt's character at the time. And, you know, I know why they did it, but still, you're trying to recreate something that simply cannot be recreated. It was kind of a poor man's attempt at recreating. You know, part of me would almost expect a milk truck to be driven out now in the PG era, to have John Cena commandeering a milk truck or something like that, which would be quite the juxtaposition between the current era and the Attitude Era when you had Steve Austin driving out there in a beer truck. But they didn't wait more than 2 years before they had Kurt Angle try to recreate the whole thing. So when you have an angle that's being recreated, you know that you have something special. And the beer truck incident is still remembered today. We see highlights of it all the time, and I'm sure we'll probably see highlights of it on July 23rd as well when they show Raw flashback moments. And this was a special moment. And for the people who were in the building that night, I don't remember exactly what arena it was. I know Mania was in Philly, so maybe it was in Pittsburgh or some other city. Wherever it may have been, it was one of the more memorable moments in the history of Monday Night Raw. Number 18 on the countdown was a moment that I was proud to have been a part of live. One of the few, if not maybe the only one, actually, on this entire list that I was there live for. It was from earlier this year, April 2nd of 2012. It was the Raw after WrestleMania, and it featured the return of former WWE champion Brock Lesnar. For the first time in, I believe, 8 years, making his first appearance on Raw, his first appearance since becoming the UFC heavyweight champion. And there was a big buzz in the building that night. Again, I was there live, and people, you know, they kind of knew that there was something going on between Brock and WWE. There had been a lot of reports online on SC Scoops and other wrestling sites about the fact that he was spotted in Miami, and he may have reached some sort of deal with the company, and throughout the entire show, they were teasing that John Cena was going to confront The Rock again, even though The Rock had beaten him fair and square the night before, and The Rock had already been out there at the beginning of the show to cut a promo. But John Cena was going to challenge The Rock. He was going to face him, you know, in the middle of the ring, face to face. And Cena came out, got the reaction that you would expect Cena to get, wasn't very well liked by the audience. And his entire promo was peppered by chants of "We want Lesnar," to the point where Cena had to stop what he was saying and just let the chants kind of subside on their own. People wanted Brock badly. They wanted Brock in the worst way, and they got him. And it's one of those rare situations where the people actually got what they asked for. You know, sometimes that doesn't happen. Or WWE will plan something, and then people will find out about it, and they'll swerve them, and they'll change all their plans and fuck everything up. But not in this case. This will go down, in my opinion, maybe as the greatest comeback, the greatest return in the history of Monday Night Raw. In terms of a segment, you know, you can make your own judgment call as far as how Brock has been handled since he's been back. It's certainly been underwhelming, I would say. But that night, you know, you couldn't have handled it any better. You know, Brock walks out, gets a monster, monster reaction from the crowd, comes down to the ring, circles the ring like a shark, circling his prey. John Cena in his big green hat and big bright green shirt standing in the middle of the ring like a giant M&M. And Brock slowly and very calmly walks up the steps, never takes his eyes off Cena, never smiles at him or anything like that, gets in the ring and extends his hand for the handshake. And as soon as Cena goes to reach in and shake the man's hand, Brock hoists him up on his shoulders. People could not have been happier, by the way, to see this. And delivers an F5. And to book Brock Lesnar's return, I don't know that I could have booked it any better than they did here. I guess the only thing maybe that I would have done, I would have had him bloody up Cena. But obviously, even though Cena, he did bloody up Cena at the pay-per-view, I guess. So We ended up getting what we wanted in that respect as well. But, you know, Brock comes out as a nice surprise, even for the people who were expecting him. I don't know that they really thought he was going to come out. So right away, you get this great reaction, and you put him in there, and the first thing he does is he beats up John Cena. I mean, you can't handle it any better than that. He leaves Cena laying, makes a mean face, poses for the crowd. They go off the air. Even after they went off the air, that was pretty much it. Brock walked out. Cena eventually walked out. Nothing really special happened off the air. But, again, in terms of comebacks and returns, there's a lot of others on this list. I mentioned The Rock. I mentioned Triple H. And they were all special in their own way. They all got great reactions from the crowds. But, again, here's Brock Lesnar, somebody who hasn't been on WWE television in 8 years, making his first appearance. He became arguably a bigger star outside of WWE after leaving the company than he was while he was there. And so he comes back kind of the conquering hero. A lot of people in the building that night wanted him to murder John Cena. He did. He gave people what they wanted. They went nuts for him. It was just great. It was one of those few times that WWE actually handled something perfectly. And in my opinion, like I said, the Brock Lesnar return earlier this year will go down as the best handled return to Monday Night Raw in the show's history. I can't think of another person who made a return, especially after that length of time. We're not talking about a return after 2 weeks or even 2 months. We're talking about a comeback after 8 years. And Brock certainly made an impact on that night, no doubt about it. I was there that night. I am very happy that I was there that night because the crowd in Miami was electric. The crowd in Miami also helped make that segment because in another town with a bunch of fans who may not know Brock, that segment could have fallen flat, and it didn't. Everything came together perfectly, and it made for a very, very special moment. Number 17 on the countdown took place on the July 16th, 2001 edition of Raw is War during the Invasion angle. An angle that I was not the biggest fan of. I've talked about this before. I think it could have been handled a hell of a lot better. But, you know, these days, wrestling's not as hot as it used to be. You kind of look back on that time period with all the WWF guys and the WCW guys, and you do sometimes look back fondly on it. And this was one of the shining moments of the Invasion angle during that period. This was the night that the old Stone Cold came back to help out Team WWF. This actually might have been the go-home show to the Invasion pay-per-view now that I think about it. If not, it was maybe a week before. But I believe it might have been the go-home show. And there were a bunch of guys brawling in the ring. The WCW and ECW guys were just beating the hell out of the WWF guys. They were outnumbered. The glass shattered. Austin came down. He had been... Vince McMahon had tried to get him to come back. He wanted the old Stone Cold and not the laughing, jokey Stone Cold. And, you know, he finally came back. He had a metamorphosis into the old Austin. And he came into the ring, and anything that moved, he gave a Stone Cold Stunner to, and the people went nuts for it. And this is even though Austin had been a vicious heel since turning heel at WrestleMania a couple months earlier. All it took was the glass shattering, this one angle, this one moment, and everybody just turned, and they were cheering for Stone Cold like it was the old days. And he gave stunners to everybody, gave stunners to, I think, D-Von and Rob Van Dam and I think Tommy Dreamer and just anybody and everybody in there. And the WWF guys fought back, of course. Undertaker and Kane delivered stereo choke slams, and they cleared house, and Austin's music played. Undertaker helped Kurt Angle to his feet because, again, all the WWF guys, Jericho, Kane, Undertaker, Austin, you know, they all had to stick up for each other. All these other feuds and storylines that may have been going on before, they all fell to the wayside because the WWF was fighting for its very existence here. And the people were going nuts. I mean, you have never heard a crowd before like you did on this night when Austin came back to help out the WWF guys, and it seemed as though the old Stone Cold was back. Of course, we would find out at the Invasion pay-per-view that it was all just a ruse, and he, in fact, was still aligned with the WCW, ECW contingent. But people didn't know that on this night, and they went absolutely nutsy cuckoo for it, is the best way that I can put it. And for one night only, at least, because, again, he still was a heel, as we would go on to find out. But for one night only, it was nice to get the old Stone Cold back. Personally, I think they made a mistake by having him turn back heel at the Invasion pay-per-view. I think it was obvious that him turning heel was a mistake. Maybe it was a mistake worth making, because I actually agreed with the way Austin felt at the time, that I felt like Austin as a babyface had gotten somewhat stale. So it's hard to look back and go, oh, you know, how could he turn heel? Well, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and I give the guy a lot of credit for actually having the guts and risking a lot of merchandise money to turn heel. But it was obvious that it wasn't working, and that really was the beginning of the end for WWE's business at that point. Not that they weren't still making a lot of money, but never again did they do business like they did before Austin turned heel. And a lot of it you can trace directly back to the heel turn. So here they had a chance to really say, you know what, this experiment isn't working. Let's just turn him back into a babyface, and we'll continue the invasion angle, but we'll keep him on the WWF side. And instead what they did was they had him turn heel, right back heel at the pay-per-view, and help the Alliance win. And we got a couple more months of heel Austin before they finally abandoned it for good. They ended up turning him babyface a couple months later anyway. I think it was a couple months too late, personally. But doesn't matter. On this night, this was a great angle. This was a great way to get people to buy the pay-per-view. And I think it's one of the reasons that the Invasion pay-per-view did as well as it did. The Invasion pay-per-view, still to this day, did the highest buy rate of any non-WrestleMania pay-per-view that WWF has ever done. To this day, that record still stands. And I think this hot angle on what I believe was the go-home show to the pay-per-view had a lot to do with that. Number 16 on the countdown took place on the May 2nd, 2005 edition of Monday Night Raw. On this particular night, we were treated to matches from a Gold Rush tournament, the brainchild of one Eric Bischoff. They were determining a number one contender for the World Heavyweight title. And on this night, Shawn Michaels was paired off with Shelton Benjamin in one of the opening round matches in the Gold Rush tournament, which was every wrestling fan's wet dream at the time. There had never been a match before between Shelton Benjamin, and Shawn Michaels. And Shelton Benjamin was one of those guys who was a star on the rise. You know, he was a guy that had a lot of potential. He was a great, great, great athlete. People thought maybe one day he could be a world champion. And wouldn't it be something to see him in the ring with Shawn Michaels? Well, we were treated to a hell of a match between the two of these guys. If I was doing a top countdown of Raw matches instead of moments, this match would be on there. And they had a great match. They had a great, great match. They actually had another match on Raw, which might have been later that same year, and that was good, but it was nothing like the original. And the moment here came at the end of the match. This, to this day, is still my all-time favorite finish to a match, certainly on Raw. Maybe of all time, I mean, that may be stretching it a little bit, I'd have to think about that, but certainly in the history of Monday Night Raw, there has never been a finish to a match that has made my jaw drop and made me go, oh shit, like we had in this match. Like I said, the match itself was great, and it built to a climax where Shawn Michaels went to throw Shelton Benjamin out of the ring, and Shelton ended up on the apron. And as Michaels retreated to the opposite side of the ring, Shelton Benjamin decided that, you know what, I'm going to go for a springboard into the ring. And I actually, at that very moment, I knew exactly what was about to happen. And it didn't matter, because it was every bit as cool and amazing when it actually happened. Shelton Benjamin propelled himself to the top rope and launched himself toward Shawn Michaels, who was on the opposite end of the ring, mind you. Now, this was an impressive feat by Shelton Benjamin, because to propel yourself that far is a pretty impressive thing. And the timing on this was just perfect. Both guys were perfect in timing this. And as Shelton came in, Michaels delivered a sweet chin music right on the jaw. I mean, right on the nose. And I'm surprised he didn't knock Benjamin's head into the 10th row. Knocked out Benjamin, got the pin, 1, 2, 3. People were just jumping out of their skin in the first few rows. As soon as he got the pinfall, in fact, they cut to a very brief shot of the front row. I think on the hard camera side, there were these two black dudes sitting next to each other in the front row. And I just remember one of them like looking at the other one, like about to cover up his mouth, like he couldn't believe what he had just seen. And that was a reaction that I had sitting at home watching this. It was just an amazing thing. They showed three different replays of it from three different angles, and it looked more impressive each time. Michaels was, he was a little bit bloodied up by his mouth. He looked like he had been in a war. And, you know, he sold this perfectly. It was just a great, great match with a great, great finish. You're not going to find a finish quite like this. It was great. Just great, great stuff that I still remember to this day. And again, if you think about it, it was just a random tournament match. They were doing this gimmick on this particular episode, and it was a great wrestling match. That happened to have a magnificent conclusion, shall we say. And unfortunately, Shelton Benjamin did not go on to, in my opinion, reach his full potential in WWE. But if I look back on the career of Shelton in the company, he's got some memorable moments. I don't think any more memorable. I know he's been Intercontinental Champion, and I think he was a Tag Team Champion. Doesn't matter. None more memorable than this match and this finish, in my opinion. And both guys deserve a lot of credit for pulling it off as well as they did. Number 15 on the top 30 list of Raw's greatest moments took place on June 7th, 2010. It was the debut of the Nexus, the night that they attacked John Cena. I remember that night vividly because I actually had missed the first part of Raw. Actually, probably the first half of the show. I believe Raw was 3 hours that night. And for whatever reason, I was at the Empire State Building. It was the first time. I've lived in New York my whole life, and I had never visited the Empire State Building. So I went up with a friend to the observatory on top, and it was fine. And I remember being on a bus heading back into back home and checking my tweets and other messages online, and people were, as usual, bitching and moaning about Raw. But they had good reason to, because I was reading the results of this three-hour snooze fest, and it was awful. Just an awful, awful show. And to me, it became obvious after what happened at the end. I would like to think that the show was only that bad because they knew they were doing something special at the end. And if they made the show so goddamn horrible, then that last angle would have that much more impact. It could very well just be that they don't know what the hell they're doing, and they just booked a shitty show with one good angle. That is entirely possible. But I tend to believe that they did so for a reason. But the show-closing angle was among the best that they've ever done on WWE television. It was a match. They were doing fan voting, and the fans had voted CM Punk, who at the time was part of the Straight Edge Society. He was wearing a lucha mask. And they had voted CM Punk to be John Cena's opponent in the main event, which I thought was telling because I think Rey Mysterio was also in the running, and people voted for CM Punk anyway. So it was Punk versus Cena a little over a year before their classic match at Money in the Bank. And NXT had, the first season of NXT had just ended not long before this. Wade Barrett had won that season. And Wade Barrett came out, and the camera panned to different parts of the crowd. There were other members from the NXT Season 1 class who were in the crowd, and Wade Barrett kind of nodded and gave the signal, and they all hopped over the barricade at once and surrounded the ring. And John Cena at that very moment was alone in the ring, or was alone standing in the ring. I don't know, Punk was either down or he was outside, wherever he was. And the Nexus jumped in the ring. They threw the referee down. John Cena knew he was outnumbered, went after Wade Barrett, and all eight men attacked him. It was Wade Barrett, it was David Otunga, it was Daniel Bryan, who would go on to be fired after an incident that took place during this angle through no fault of his own. Michael Tarver was there. I think Heath Slater was part of it as well. The current Ryback, Skip Sheffield at the time, was there. Justin Gabriel, and I may be missing one other person, but Darren Young, Black John Cena, as we've come to know him as. So they all attack John Cena. The announcers don't know what to make of this, and at that moment, Skip Sheffield and Heath Slater, they go outside, they beat up Matt Stryker, who was standing at ringside for reasons I don't recall why. They went after the announcers. They went after Jerry Lawler. Michael Cole ran off like a scalded dog, which fed the rumors that perhaps Michael Cole was in some way behind this NXT invasion. Unfortunately, he wasn't. I say unfortunately only because that would have been a good way to get Michael Cole off commentary and in a heel kind of manager capacity, which I think he would have been a lot better in at the time. He wasn't a very good announcer when he was doing the heel shtick. Nor is he today, quite frankly, when he does the heel shtick on Raw. So they beat up the announcers. Sheffield overturned the announce table on top of Lawler. People were going nuts. They started chanting NXT, NXT. It was very similar, obviously, to an NWO angle. We used to see them every single week, routinely, on Monday Nitro. And this really harkened back to those days of just chaos, when the NWO would come out on Nitro, the show would stop, the announcers would be, chased away, if not beaten up. People would get spray painted and the announce table would be overturned. It was very, very reminiscent to that. And something else that also happened on this night, besides Daniel Bryan choking out Justin Roberts with his tie and subsequently being fired for it, they were ripping apart the ring. I mean, they were tearing the ring apart, tearing the ring ropes down. They were throwing things all over the place, and they ripped up the padding on the ring. And for the first time probably ever in the history of WWE television, the plywood under the ring mat was exposed. I mean, we had never seen that before. I mean, they were just tearing everything to shreds. And poor John Cena was left alone in the ring. He was being beaten up. He took a couple of clotheslines. And one of the things that really put this angle over the top for me, I mean, all that stuff was great. The announcers, you know, beating up the announcers was great. And it lent, you know, the sense of helplessness almost. It was also kind of funny that there was a fan who leaned over the barricade and actually grabbed the hammer for the ring bell and started ringing the bell. I thought that was kind of funny. But what really helped sell this whole thing was CM Punk, who was a heel at the time. And CM Punk had absolutely no reason to help out John Cena. CM Punk climbed back into the ring and went after the Nexus. So it really felt like this was an invasion. This wasn't like so much a heel-face dynamic. I really thought that was a nice little touch there, and I wonder who thought of that, if it was Punk himself or if it was the writers and the people putting the segment together. I don't know. But it was a nice little touch that really added to the realism of the angle. And so the Nexus, of course, ganged up on Punk, and they were beating him up. I like how it was Daniel Bryan, of all people, that ended up kicking Punk the hardest and knocked him out of the ring. And anyway, John Cena was left laying. He took a 450 splash by Justin Gabriel. The Nexus walked out. The entire ringside area looked like a war zone. I mean, it looked like a freaking tornado had blown through it. Officials were down. Justin Roberts was down. John Cena was down. CM Punk was down. The announcers were down, except Michael Cole, who ran off like a little bitch. This was a great, great angle, and I remember the enthusiasm that people had when this was over. I went online to, you know, Twitter, Facebook, message board forums. I talked to some of my own friends who had seen the show, and they were completely enthralled and just captivated by this angle, and they thought to themselves, wow, this could be the second coming of the NWO. This could be the hot angle that really propels WWE into its next boom period. And, you know, maybe that would have been overstating it a little bit, but I think the potential was certainly there, because the Nexus was hot for a long time after this. You know, they did an angle several weeks later where they beat up some legends. They beat up Ricky Steamboat. Unfortunately, they beat up Ricky Steamboat a little bit too much, and he ended up suffering a brain aneurysm, and really, you know, he's recovered mostly since then, but he's still not able to get physical in training down in FCW. But the Nexus was hot, you know, and it made a difference in the ratings. People were genuinely interested in the product. It was something that really was, I think the product needed to be shaken up a bit at the time. It needed to be freshened up in some way, and the Nexus thing was just perfect. And it was perfect also because you're doing it with young guys. So yeah, maybe not all these guys are going to end up becoming stars, but if one or two, three, if you're really, really lucky, go on to become an upper mid-card guy or a main event level guy. And Wade Barrett certainly can be a main event level guy. Daniel Bryan has proven that he is main event material. You know, you have Otunga in there who they've tried to push before, and then they've, you know, obviously they start and they stop. They've given up on him. They use him as a jobber now. But I like that they were doing it with the younger guys, because you're not just taking old guys like the old farts club and trying to, you know, put them in there and shoehorn them into a main event angle. You're doing a main event angle that's actually working and that's actually getting people excited, and you're doing it with young guys that long term you want these guys to become the future of your company. So I loved everything about this angle. And then at SummerSlam, of course, it all went to shit because the Nexus lost. They lost to John Cena and Team WWF. Even when they did the original invasion angle back in 01 that I talked about a little while ago with the WCW guys, and I wasn't too fond of them turning Steve Austin heel again after they had seemingly turned him back to being a babyface. You know, I liked the fact at least that the Alliance won at the invasion pay-per-view, because it prolonged it a little bit longer. It kept the angle going. I mean, they were able to milk that thing until Survivor Series that year before they killed it. They could have done the exact same thing with the Nexus in 2010. Have the Nexus win at SummerSlam. I mean, they were barely 2 months old. It was like a newborn. And they smothered their newborn at the pay-per-view. Because the minute they lost, they were done. They were finished. It was over. You could have kept that thing going until Survivor Series and done a War Game-style match with Team WWF against the Nexus. Unfortunately, they did not do that. But I'm going off on a tangent here. For one night, this angle was just gold. This was a golden angle that got people genuinely excited about the product. And regardless of what ended up happening, in my opinion, it's probably one of the... It is. It's not... This is a statement of fact as far as I'm concerned. It's one of the best angles they've ever done in the history of Monday Night Raw. Number 14 was the debut of Eric Bischoff as the Raw General Manager. It was July 15th, 2002, one of those surreal moments that you never really expected to see, but by God, there it is, right before your very eyes. Vince McMahon introducing Eric Bischoff as the new GM, both men embracing, hugging on the stage in front of the world. And Jim Ross on commentary was just great. I think this was where he made a comment about, wow, am I a lucky, like, big fat Oklahoman or something like that. Because, of course, he once worked for Eric Bischoff, and they didn't get along very well. And so all of a sudden, Bischoff is back, and he's part of Raw. And therefore, Jim Ross is technically now working for Eric Bischoff again. So he was great on commentary, talking about how as Vince and Eric were hugging on stage, they were probably picking each other's pockets as well. And, you know, you look back, this was certainly a memorable angle, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention all the reasons they fucked this up. First of all, they made a mistake, in my opinion, by revealing who it was before the segment. I mean, that would have been a nice surprise, and they went and they fucked it up because the commercial break beforehand, they did this backstage segment with Booker T, and they showed Eric Bischoff walking by. Why in the hell would you do that? If you're having Vince McMahon come out to do this big reveal, why wouldn't you just save it? You know, wait 4 minutes until after the commercial and save it as a surprise. But I guess they wanted people to tell their friends and to tune in and whatever. I always thought that was a load of shit the way they handled that. But just the fact that in Bischoff's debut, you would have him embracing Vince McMahon. You would have the two of them almost like bosom buddies. These are two men who were at war with each other for years. Like the King said on commentary that night, which was a shoot, you know, Bischoff, here's a guy that Vince McMahon used to wish death upon when Lawler worked with McMahon in the announce booth on Monday Night Raw during the Monday Night Wars. It's bad enough that, you know, WWF waited far too long during the invasion angle to bring in guys like Bischoff and Flair and Hogan and Hall and Nash. And had they brought even some of those guys in right away, perhaps the angle would have had more legs and would have been even more successful than it was, and they could have built some sort of big supercar type show at WrestleMania the following year. But, you know, I think that bringing Bischoff in the way that they did was a mistake. There was a lot of potential there to do something big between him and McMahon. You don't bring Bischoff in first as a friend. I know later on McMahon and Bischoff ended up feuding, but by then it didn't mean much because Eric Bischoff was just another guy. You know, he was just another character on TV, whereas if you somehow could have done an angle where Bischoff is trying to get into the company, trying to get power, maybe another McMahon member like Stephanie or somebody who was feuding with her father at the time kind of gets Eric in, or Eric is trying to raid the company and start his own company or something like that. And maybe even build to a Vince McMahon-Eric Bischoff match, which, shockingly enough, we never actually got. I think would have been a far, far better way to debut him. But still, the sight of Eric Bischoff even being on Raw and holding up hands with Vince McMahon on that stage is one of those surreal Raw moments that you don't forget. And for that reason alone, it had to be on this list because, I mean, for God's sakes, Eric Bischoff debuting on Raw, how could that not be on any list of top Raw moments from over the years? Number 13 in the countdown is one of my personal favorites. It's one of these moments that probably isn't going to be on a lot of other people's lists, but should be. It took place on the February 7th, 2000 edition of Monday Night Raw from, I believe it was Reunion Arena in Dallas, Texas. And again, if I was doing a list of top matches in the history of Monday Night Raw, the 10-man tag in Dallas on this night would be easily in the top five, at least, of this list. It was a 10-man tag. It was The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool against Triple H and The Radicals, sans Eddie Guerrero, who had suffered an injury and he was on the outside during this match. Actually, I think X-Pac might have been in the match, too. Maybe it was Triple H, X-Pac, Chris Benoit, Perry Saturn, and I forget who the other person would have been. But maybe Dean Malenko. But this was a great, 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 great match with a hot, hot crowd. The crowd, let me tell you something. When you have a hot crowd, it can make all the difference in the world. This would have been a great match regardless. With this, it was an awesome match. And the atmosphere was just electric for it. And in the end, the bad guys won through a little bit of chicanery. When the match was over, the New Age Outlaws ran down with lead pipes, the heels were beating up on the baby faces, and all of a sudden the lights went out. And Stephanie McMahon Helmsley had been on commentary with JR and the King, and she's panicking, and she's accusing JR somehow of turning out the lights, and JR says, "I didn't do anything, Stephanie." And some of the lights then come back on, and all of a sudden we see a figure emerge from the stage, and it is Paul Bearer. First time we had seen Paul Bearer probably in, well, let's see, I guess the last time Paul Bearer would have been seen would have been probably the previous year, so it wasn't that long, but he had been gone probably at least 6 months. And it looked like he had lost some weight, he was wearing a red jacket, and all of a sudden Kane's music hit. Now, this was Kane's big return. Now, keep in mind, Kane had literally only been gone for maybe 2 weeks. So I always laugh when I look back on this, and they made such a big deal about how Kane is back, and I think his look may have been different. He may have had a new outfit, too. He literally was gone for 2, maybe 3 weeks at the most. But the way they handled this was great. People went crazy for it. Kane was being escorted down the ring by Paul Bearer, and he, you know, went into the ring, beat up on all the heels, and beat up on X-Pac, beat up on Billy Gunn, beat up on Perry Saturn, and the heels ran off, and that was pretty much it. But the match, the atmosphere, the post-match stuff with Kane's, you know, big two-week comeback, Paul Bearer was probably the bigger return of the two of them. This was just electric. Find the match on YouTube or Daily Motion. I know it's out there. This was great, great stuff. And the funny little backstory to it is that originally, as I understand it, this was supposed to be the return of The Undertaker. The Undertaker had been off television since September of the previous year. He had undergone surgery. And I believe the plan was for him to come back, for Paul Bearer to come back with him. And in training and in rehab, Undertaker suffered another injury. He actually suffered a torn pec muscle. And Kane, I believe, was instead slotted in this position for a grand return. Of course, what ended up happening is about 2 or 3 months later, Undertaker finally did come back, and that was as the American Badass. So, again, that was always the story at the time. Whether it's the truth, I have no way of knowing for sure. I mean, if the plan was for Undertaker to come back as the American Badass, I really can't see Paul Bearer coming back with Undertaker as the American Badass. So I'm not quite sure how accurate that story exactly is all these years later. But I'm glad things worked out the way they did because, like I said, watching it as a viewer at the time, it was electric. It was just such a fun match to watch. Because everybody at the time was so goddamn over. I mean, The Rock was the top star in the company with Austin out. He was the number one babyface. Cactus Jack Foley, of course, he was over. Rikishi and Too Cool were just over like gangbusters at the time. That act was really, really hot. The Radicals had literally just come over a couple of weeks earlier, and obviously we know their pedigree. They're great wrestlers, so they're in there taking great bumps, and they're, you know, just doing great stuff. Everybody was on their A game in this match, and then just to kind of cap it off with that big comeback at the end and have Kane clear house and everyone's going crazy, it was a great, great Raw moment that, again, I don't think gets enough attention. I think it kind of gets lost in the shuffle, but it was a great moment for sure, one of my favorite all-time Raw moments, and if you've never seen it, you owe it to yourself to find it online. We move to number 12 on the countdown, which is one of the all-time memorable Raw moments, September 22nd. 1997, Raw from Madison Square Garden in New York City. And I'm trying to think, it may well have been the very first Raw from Madison Square Garden now that I think about it. A lot of big things happening on this night. It was actually the WWF debut of Cactus Jack. That might have been the night they did the Three Faces of Foley video, and Cactus Jack came out to fight Triple H in a street fight, so that was a fun match. But the big moment on this show came in the form of a Stone Cold Stunner. Vince McMahon, who by this point everybody pretty much knew that Vince was kind of the chairman, he was the head of the company, but he was still announcer Vince. And I love the way the WWF slowly built this up because Austin had been dropped on his head at SummerSlam by Owen Hart. He was hurt, he couldn't wrestle. And he was obviously very frustrated, he had to forfeit his tag team titles because of it, he ended up having to forfeit the Intercontinental title as well. And at the pay-per-view in September, Austin took his frustrations out on his good buddy Jim Ross, and he had given Jim Ross a stunner at the pay-per-view. I believe that was the Ground Zero show. And then about a week or two later on Raw, he ended up giving a stunner to Jerry the King Lawler. So, it only made sense. When is Vince McMahon going to get his stunner? Everybody was waiting for it. people were, it was palpable. People could not wait to see Vince McMahon be assaulted. And you didn't see that very often on the show. He had been bounced around a little bit, but nobody had ever beaten up Vince McMahon before. And so, well, I guess Bret Hart did in Montreal, but that hadn't happened yet by this point. So Austin came out, he attacked Owen Hart, cops swarmed him in the ring. Vince McMahon did not want to see one of his star attractions be brutalized by the New York City Police Department, threw the headset off his head, jumped in the ring with a microphone. And he confronted Austin. He talked about how, you know, him being suspended and not being allowed to wrestle is for Austin's own good. He has to work within the system. People care about him. And Austin got on the mic and said, I appreciate the fact that you and the World Wrestling Federation care. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that, you know, this and that and whatever. And he said, I also appreciate the fact that, hell, you can kiss my ass. And he proceeded to give Vince a stunner, which wasn't Austin's fault, but it was one of the worst stunners you'll ever see. Vince took the stunner and proceeded to flop around like a fish on the mat. His eyes were wide, bug-eyed open. And as I said, he was like a fish out of water, just flopping around. Austin drops down, of course, gives him the head shake and flips him off. People go crazy. The cops arrest him and haul him off to jail. But this was just one of those landmark moments that it was being built up and built up and built up. Austin was a star on the rise. People could see it. People could see he was going to be the next big star, the next big baby face. Hopefully he'd be able to come back, because there was still some question at this point about what Austin's long-term prognosis was going to be. His neck was in pretty bad shape. Obviously, it would catch up to him a couple years later. He would still have to retire prematurely, but thankfully, he was eventually able to come back. But the very first stunner to Vince McMahon is going to be on anybody's top list of Raw moments, probably even in the top 10, which tells you how many great moments there are, that this is only number 12 on my list. It didn't even crack the top 10, but yeah, not the best stunner in the world, but nonetheless, it was the stunner heard around the world. And I actually have fond memories of Raw that night. I remember that show ended with a double chokeslam, Undertaker chokeslamming both Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels at the same time. This was the highlight of the top of the hour, by the way. This wasn't even the main event of the show. The funny thing is, I remember hearing that the reason they did this so early in the show is because, again, there was a lot of tension and animosity back then between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, and obviously they were going to work together in that final segment. And Vince kind of wanted to get it over with so he can go backstage and mediate things and make sure things were cool between Bret and Shawn. So that's why they did the segment so early in the show. At least, again, that's the story that I remember hearing at the time. Who knows whether it's true or not. The number 11 moment took place on April 17th, 2000 in State College, Pennsylvania. This is one of my favorite all-time Raw moments. It was a WWF Championship match between Triple H and Chris Jericho. This was actually the go-home show to the Backlash pay-per-view, which happened to be the year that The Rock beat Triple H for the WWF Championship, one of the bigger title changes of that era back then. Triple H, of course, had retained his title at WrestleMania, a rare feat for a heel at the time, and Rock came back next month and beat him for the title. But 6 days before the pay-per-view, we had this match between Jericho and Triple H. Jericho, at the time, he was a babyface, still on the rise in WWF, had not really been given a shot at being a main eventer quite yet. But the crowd was sure into him, and he had convinced Triple H to give him a title shot at the beginning of the show. And they had a pretty good match, and I believe what ended up happening, if I remember correctly, is the official for the match was knocked out. I think the official was Mike Chioda, and referee Earl Hebner ran down to replace him. Now, Earl Hebner had some heat at the time with the McMahon-Helmsley regime, which was the faction that was running amok in WWF at the time. When Triple H saw that Earl was now the referee for his match, he was none too happy, gave Earl a shove. Earl shoved him back, and then Triple H shoved Earl down. And Chris Jericho came out of nowhere, blindsided Triple H with a spinning heel kick, nailed him with the lion salt off the ropes. Earl Hebner rolled over, counted the quick three count, which was obviously a fast count, and the place exploded. People went crazy. Jim Ross went crazy on commentary, kept chanting Jericho's name over and over again. And Lillian Garcia announced that Chris Jericho was, in fact, the new WWF champion. And people thought they really did just see a title change, that Jericho had just won his first world championship, and it was a big deal. And the APA were at ringside. They were holding Triple H back from getting Earl Hebner, and Jericho was in the ring, so Triple H went back, and Jericho left the ring and went up the ramp and was celebrating with Bradshaw and Farouk, and It was a really fun moment, and the fun came to an end after the commercial break. Triple H brought Earl Hebner from the back into the ring, and he also brought the original referee, Mike Chioda, in. They showed a replay of what had happened. Mike Chioda admitted that, hey, Earl, you screwed Triple H. And ultimately, Triple H had Earl Hebner agree to reverse the decision so long as he was a WWF referee. Triple H would never, ever lay his hands on him again. And Triple H agreed to this. The title was given back to Triple H, and Jericho's victory was basically expunged from the record. It didn't count. Triple H said it never, ever happened. And obviously, Triple H ended up pedigreeing Earl Hebner because, you see, he agreed not to attack Earl Hebner so long as he was a referee, but at the time, Triple H had the authority to hire and fire people, much as he does today. So he first fired Earl Hebner, and then he left him laying. So, in the end, it did not count as a title reign for Chris Jericho. But for those of us who were either in the building that night or saw it live on television, it's one of those moments that you don't ever forget. Jericho, his phantom title win back in 2000 is fondly remembered by a lot of fans, and really was one of the more exciting moments in the history of Raw. It was one of the hottest opens to a Raw show that they probably ever had, to be honest with you. That whole first half hour plus, from the actual match to the title change to the drama with the referee when they came back from commercial break, all that stuff was just great, great, great stuff. Just a really fun moment. That takes care of the first 20 moments. We're now down to the top 10 greatest Raw moments in history. And we're going to lead off the top 10 here with number 10. And I would be remiss if I didn't include this. And it's one of those moments, really, where you have to include it in the top 10 because, realistically, it was probably the first truly shocking, memorable moment in the history of Monday Night Raw. I know in the first few, we had the original show, of course, at the Manhattan Center on January 11th of 93. You had Mr. Perfect beating Ric Flair in a Loser Leaves Town match and all of that stuff. But the first truly shocking moment in the history of Raw, and to this day what I consider to be the biggest upset in the history of Monday Night Raw, took place on May 17th, 1993 at the Manhattan Center. There were actually two significant events that occurred on this show, one of which was a title change. We had Marty Jannetty making his return and beating Shawn Michaels to become the Intercontinental Champion on this show. He would go on to lose the title about a month later, maybe a little less, at a house show to Shawn, with some assistance from Shawn's brand new bodyguard, Kevin Nash, who of course was portraying the role of Diesel for the first time. The other significant event that happened on this show was a match between Razor Ramon and a relative unknown at the time called the 1-2-3 Kid, Sean Waltman. Now, Waltman, I believe he did some jobs on WWE television leading up to this just to build the fact that he was, in fact, an enhancement guy. He also wrestled independently as the Lightning Kid. He actually was making quite a name for himself on the independent scene, and WWF signed him. He was put in this match with Razor, who, of course, at the time was a mid-card to upper mid-card heel. Certainly nobody watching this match would have really noticed anything any different. I'm sure they would have just expected Razor to take care of this guy in short order and be done with him. And what ended up happening was the Kid beat Razor. He gave him a moonsault off the top rope, his knee clocked Razor in the face, 1-2-3, and he got the pin. And the Manhattan Center went bonkers. Bobby Heenan went bonkers. Macho Man went bonkers. Vince McMahon went bonkers. It was a big-time Raw moment. And the Kid celebrated. He leapt up into the air. He jumped. He ran to the back. Razor couldn't believe it. He was beside himself. It was one of those things that you didn't see very often. I mean, you fast forward to 95. You have Chris Candido as Skip losing to Barry Horowitz. And, you know, you can point to other examples over the years, although none that really pop into my head at this very moment. Razor losing to the Kid was the first big, shocking kind of upset loss of its kind that I can remember as a younger viewer at the time. I can't really compare it or relate it to anything. It was just so shocking. And again, back then I didn't have cable TV until 95, so I heard about it, you know, when I watched Superstars or Wrestling Challenge or whatever it was that weekend, and they really made it out to be a big deal. And for the Kid, it was a star-making opportunity. Of course, there was a rematch. Razor was willing to put, I think, $10,000 of his money on the line against the Kid, and I think the Kid ended up just stealing the money and running out of the building into a waiting car. But it was that victory that really propelled him to being somebody in the WWF. He was never a main eventer, But Razor really put him over in that match. And it really helped make him a star. And you don't see enough of that these days, I don't think. You don't see enough matches like that where in one fell swoop, in one night, somebody can be made a star. Well, on this episode of Raw, the kid became a star, and it's all thanks to Razor Ramon. And that was in 1993. I mean, think about that. That's almost 20 years ago. And I still remember it like it was yesterday. It was a very special moment. And to me, you can't have a top 10 list of memorable Raw moments without including that somewhere. And so I felt I had to include it at number 10 just to get it in the top 10 because it does deserve to be there. The number 9 greatest moment in Monday Night Raw history took place on July 9th, 2001. And July 9th, 01 is an interesting show to me because for as great as this moment is at number 9, what happened at the end of this show practically undid all of the good that came out of this. It's like literally going from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows. But we're going to focus on the highest of highs here because on this show there was a tag team match that pitted Kane and Chris Jericho against the team of Lance Storm and Mike Awesome, who were among the invading talents from WCW. This was toward the beginning of the invasion angle, a couple weeks before the invasion pay-per-view. And on this night, two former ECW talents, Tommy Dreamer and Rob Van Dam, both made their WWE debuts. Now, both men had actually appeared on Raw before, many years earlier. It was RVD, I think, who first made his appearance on Raw in 97. Tommy Dreamer might have been in 96. They had done a previous angle with ECW many years ago, but we don't count that. For all intents and purposes, this was their WWF debut. And they ran in during this match to interfere. And when they ran in to interfere, they attacked Kane and Jericho. And down to the ring, seemingly to their aid, came the likes of Raven, Taz, the Dudleys. There were a few others as well. Maybe Rhino might have been a part of that. And when they stood in the ring, you kind of looked at them and looked at these guys and you realized that, you know, there's something kind of similar about all these so-called WWF guys that just ran down to help out Chris Jericho and Kane. They're all former ECW guys. So you thought to yourself, this seems a little weird, but okay. So all the former ECW guys are lined up next to each other in the ring with their backs turned to Kane and Jericho, and they're facing off with Storm and Awesome and RVD and Dreamer. And all of a sudden, the other ECW, who are also WWF guys, like Taz and the Dudleys and Raven and all of them, they suddenly do a slow turn. And they turn, and now everybody is standing in the middle of the ring facing Kane and Jericho. And JR on commentary sold this perfectly. Because he was just incredulous towards the entire thing. He's like, what the hell? He kept screaming, what the hell is this? What the hell is this? As all of the ECW guys ran after Jericho and Kane to attack them. And soon it was like 10-on-1. And it was just this massive beatdown of the two WWF guys in the middle of the ring by these former ECW talents. And Jim Ross on commentary, he didn't understand what was going on. He didn't know. He turned to Paul Heyman. He wanted to know what was going on. Paul Heyman, who was doing commentary with JR, finally gets up from the table, goes into the ring. I think it was Bubba Ray Dudley who opened the ropes, letting Heyman into the ring. And Heyman did what Heyman does best. He cut a promo. He cut a work shoot promo. And basically, this was Paul Heyman reforming ECW as a faction in the WWF. He called Jim Ross a pig. He said that in this war between the WWF guys and the WCW guys, what had gotten lost in the middle of all this was the Tribe of Extreme. And the way this whole thing was done was just magnificent. You had all the ECW guys in the ring smiling and laughing and, you know, slapping high five. And it really introduced an exciting element to this invasion angle, because now you had this third party involved, this kind of rebel, renegade group of guys, and you didn't know who, you couldn't trust them, you know. The ECW guys were always portrayed as wild and crazy and hardcore, and, you know, you've got Paul Heyman now leading this contingent. Now it just feels like complete chaos. It was great. It was awesome. And, of course, what ended up happening at the end of the show was the ECW guys ended up merging and aligning with the WCW guys. And Stephanie McMahon was revealed to be the, quote, owner of ECW. And I think there's a famous on one of the sound-offs I did. I've talked about this before, and there's a soundbite that I've used on some of my other sound-off episodes from that one show that I did where I talked about this angle, and I believe I said, dead, in the water. And that's what it was. In my opinion, that angle was dead at that point because they had something truly exciting, and they just completely fucked it up at the end of that show. So if you just ignore the end of that show, this particular moment with the ECW reunion of sorts midway through Raw on July 9th of 01 was just a fantastic moment. And I didn't grow up a huge fan of ECW. I became more of an ECW fan after the fact. During the peak days of ECW, I really didn't focus on it too much and wasn't able to watch the shows very often. So I wasn't even what you would consider a diehard ECW fan, and this excited me. I can only imagine what it would have been like for a former hardcore ECW fanatic to have seen this on Monday Night Raw. I'm sure it was a very exciting moment that unfortunately only lasted about an hour, but that was still a pretty fun hour nonetheless. The number 8 moment on the countdown took place on August 9th, 1999. I remember waiting an entire summer for this moment to come to fruition, and it did. It started with a Millennium Countdown that I believe started airing on WWE television in June that summer. And on August the 9th, the Millennium Countdown hit zero in the middle of a Rock promo. And out came Chris Jericho, making his WWF debut for the very first time. And people in the audience knew it. There were Jericho signs, Raw is Jericho and the like, all over the place. As a matter of fact, the arena went dark, and there was a pyro explosion, and there was a pretty cool Titantron video that came on. And the moment that the word Jericho flashed on the screen, the place went nuts. People were going crazy. Jericho's standing there with his arms outstretched. He says, Raw is Jericho. He turns around. The people cheer for him even more. And he got the crowd to turn on him pretty quickly once he actually started cutting a promo. He was talking about how he was the Ayatollah of rock and roll. A lot of these catchphrases that he's become synonymous for, we heard for the first time that night. He talked about being our party host and the savior of the WWF and all this. And, of course, The Rock had his own great retort. He asked Jericho what his name is. He cut him off, said, it doesn't matter what your name is. Not bad for a first night if you're Chris Jericho, who had been, in his view, misused during his days in WCW. The last straw for him was he had this great creative idea for a brief feud with Bill Goldberg at the time. And Jericho, you know, talked about this in his book. He didn't have any illusions as far as whether or not he would ever beat Goldberg or anything like that. But he had this idea, and it was a pretty cool idea where he was taunting Goldberg, and I think he may have done this match once against like a Goldberg cutout or something like that. And apparently in real life, Goldberg didn't take too kindly to it, and WCW never really did do anything with Jericho, and so he pretty much knew at that point he was on his way out. And his first night in, he's in the ring interrupting The Rock, of all people. And he didn't exactly start with a feud against The Rock. Jericho did kind of have to work his way up. He had a lot of enemies behind the scenes, and he had a feud with China, which is, you know, less memorable. But on this night, Jericho was king. This was his crowning moment. His debut pretty much went off without a hitch. People knew who he was. There were obviously people expecting him to be there that night, hoping that the Millennium Countdown was for him. It was a very creative debut, let's put it that way. And I said before that I think Brock Lesnar's return earlier this year on Raw is maybe the greatest return for a superstar in the history of the show. Chris Jericho's debut is probably, I would say that Jericho's debut probably was the greatest superstar debut in the history of the show. I've done top 10 lists for SE Scoops before where I think I might have even done one about top wrestler debuts. I don't remember. And I always waffle back and forth on whether or not Kane or Chris Jericho or even Taz. I think those three probably had the best debuts in WWF history. And I always waffle back and forth between Jericho and Kane. And I think I usually go with Kane. Just because it was on such a bigger scale, you know, the main event of a pay-per-view, very first Hell in a Cell, and, you know, The Undertaker's brother. But Chris Jericho's debut is probably right behind Kane's at number two, maybe all time in the company. And certainly in terms of Raw moments, it's a top 10 moment for sure. Jericho went on to become one of the biggest stars in company history, the first undisputed champion, all that good stuff. But it all started with the Millennium Countdown on this show back in 1999. Number 7 on the countdown is from March 26, 2001, the infamous Raw Nitro simulcast. It was the final official edition of WCW Monday Nitro on TNT. A sad day for some, certainly a lot sadder looking back on the state of the wrestling business today and the lack of any real competition for WWE makes you wish WCW was still around. But at the time, it was almost like a mercy killing because WCW sucked so badly at the time. It was just begging for somebody to put a bullet in the back of its head. And Vince McMahon was that person. He put a bullet in the back of his head. He bought out some of the lower card wrestler contracts and all the trademarks and copyrights and all that stuff. And on this night, it was a simulcast where you can actually, Raw and Nitro essentially were airing, footage was airing on both USA and TNT. It was quite the surreal experience. And Vince McMahon came out on Raw to officially announce that he had bought his competition. It was his crowning achievement. He had defeated Ted Turner, even though Turner at this point really didn't have anything to do at all with WCW. But Vince carried a grudge, obviously, and looked very happy to be standing in the middle of the ring, taking great glee and great joy in announcing the demise of his competition. And he did this survey of the crowd. He mentioned a bunch of WCW names just to see what sort of reaction it would get from the audience. He mentioned Lex Luger and Sting and Buff Bagwell and I think Booker T and some other people. And then Vince made the announcement that WCW was dead. He wasn't going to do anything with them. And that's when Shane McMahon appeared on the Titantron. He was in Panama City Beach, Florida. It was actually the spring break edition of Nitro was the final Nitro. And there was Shane McMahon standing in the middle of a WCW ring, cutting a promo from a different location on his father. And ultimately, Shane announced that he now owned WCW. That was the big bombshell blockbuster announcement. Again, so many different ways they could have gone with this. You look back on it now and you just shake your head. I mean, this was it. I mean, this right here was it. This was the big money angle. This, coupled with the invasion, this was the pot of gold for WWE at the end of that rainbow. And while they did make quite a bit of money off it, just they left so many millions of dollars on the table. There were so many different ways they could have gone. They could have kept Nitro going. That was certainly the plan at first, was to actually, and I find this hard to believe, but this was the actual plan. Vince McMahon was going to give Nitro the Raw time slot. Raw was basically going to become Nitro. And SmackDown, whether it would have still been SmackDown or if SmackDown's name would have changed to Raw, I don't know, but that would have been the WWF show. And that was the plan for quite some time. They were having creative meetings in Titan Tower, backstage. Jim Ross was in the meetings, and all the agents. They were trying to go over the different ideas, who was going to be part of what roster. And then, of course, came the infamous Raw main event in Tacoma, Washington, between Booker T and Buff Bagwell that pretty much sealed the fate of WCW once and for all with that god-awful match. But on this night, This was about as big as it gets, because the war waged for so many years. It was such a horrible, well, not horrible, I guess, but I mean, there was a lot of bad things, mean things, I guess you could say, going back and forth. People would always jump ship, and Eric Bischoff would go on the air early and announce the results for the taped Raw show for that night. And it was a war for many years, make no mistake. And WWF won the war. They beat their competition. They bought them out. This was Vince McMahon's big moment. His son announced that he had bought WCW, and at least for the time being, there were a lot of excited people. People thought that maybe WCW would actually continue on in some capacity, and even though it didn't. So you have to include this in those top 10 Raw moments, because so many Raw moments from over the years took place during that Monday Night Wars time period, that when the Monday Night Wars actually came to an end in such grand fashion, and they did this simulcast, it's one of those memorable moments we'll never have ever again. Doesn't matter how much success TNA may have, and TNA's certainly doing a lot better these days creatively. Their ratings, not so much, but you're never going to have competition on that level again for WWE. I really don't think so. You never say never. You hope that there is at some point. All it takes is a good TV slot and somebody with a lot of cash, but I don't see anything like that happening on the horizon, and it was a time period in wrestling that we'll never have ever again. This was about as surreal a moment. I talked before about Bischoff and Vince embracing on stage, and that was pretty surreal, but that's one guy. This was an entire company going belly up, And to actually bear witness to this on television was something that I never thought I'd actually see, but it happened. Number 6 on the countdown of Raw's top 30 greatest moments is another one of those moments that is near and dear to me. It's one of my personal favorites. I'm sure it would be on some lists, but maybe not all. It took place on March the 17th, 1997. Again, yet another go-home show before WrestleMania. This one, WrestleMania 13. On this particular episode, it was the Hitman Bret Hart challenging Psycho Sid in the main event inside a steel cage for the WWF Championship. Bret's last chance to win the title heading into WrestleMania. What could have been a title match between Bret Hart and Steve Austin for the championship. That's kind of what was on the line here. And in the end, Bret Hart did not succeed. Undertaker slammed a cage door in his face to protect his own title shot at WrestleMania. Sid beat Bret. And when we came back from commercial break, we saw people deconstructing the cage. And as the cage was being taken apart, Bret Hart, hands on hips, was pretty upset, standing in the middle of the ring. And announcer Vince McMahon climbs through the ropes and proceeds to attempt to interview Bret Hart. He tells Bret Hart he must be terribly frustrated over what has just happened, and no sooner does Vince say that than Bret Hart shoves him on his ass. And I mentioned earlier that it had become commonplace, obviously, over the last several years to see authority figures get beaten up and humiliated on television, and when Vince McMahon took that first stunner from Steve Austin at the Garden in late 97, it was a watershed moment in a lot of ways, because you know, we had already seen Eric Bischoff get beat up on WCW television. Gorilla Monsoon got beat up by Vader. Vince McMahon had actually taken a bump himself once before, way back when in 91. He actually took a chair shot once on television from Ric Flair, or maybe it was Roddy Piper. It was an accidental chair shot. But the first time Vince McMahon really got shoved on his ass wasn't by Steve Austin. It was by Bret Hart, and it was early in 1997, long before Montreal and long before Steve Austin started to get hot, and it was here. And Vince got shoved down, and it's funny looking back on the footage because you watch the reaction of the people in the front row, and it's like they can't believe what they're seeing. There were these two guys who actually were sitting down just as this was happening, and as soon as Vince fell on his ass, they sat right back up, or they stood right back up, I should say. And Bret Hart proceeded to cut a profanity-laced promo, the likes of which we had never seen before on a wrestling show. And it was not bleeped. He said it was bullshit. Everybody screws me. Nobody does a goddamn thing about it. He threw a whole bunch of goddams and shits around. And he finished off his promo by telling the fans, if you don't like it, tough shit. And what followed was Steve Austin on the Titantron cutting a promo on Bret. And Bret challenged him to come out. And Sid came out. There was a whole big four-way brawl involving Bret, Sid, Austin, and Undertaker. And Shawn Michaels eventually came out as well, really not to do anything but just stand around, because supposedly he was injured with his fake knee injury at that time. And this is significant for you know, a couple of different reasons. First of all, we had never seen anything like this before on Raw. Bret Hart, the great hero, the great babyface for many years, is on Raw cursing up a storm, telling the fans, you know, tough shit. It was also the reason that Raw went on a 7-second delay. Because Raw, at least the times that Raw was live, Raw was not always live back then. Obviously, this show was. And obviously, they did not have a 7-second delay. And after that, they did. And the reason they do now is because of that one promo back in 1997. Because I don't want to say USA Network didn't know about it, because I'm sure they did. In fact, I'm positive WWF gave them a heads up. Maybe they weren't aware of the extent to which Bret Hart would be using salty language on TV. But to me, they had to at least have been aware that something like this was going to happen. But that's why we got the 7-second delay in the years that followed. And it's one of those cool Raw moments to look back on. You know, it was the first time Bret Hart had a real meltdown on TV. And it's interesting to look back on it in some ways, because many months later, we all know what happened in Montreal and the talk about how Bret got screwed, and yet here he is in March of 1997, long before Montreal ever happened, long before Montreal was even conceived of, ranting and raving like a madman in the middle of the ring about how he always gets screwed. Maybe there was something to it. He thought he was getting screwed long before Montreal, so maybe there was something to that after all. But this was pretty cool, and obviously it was something shocking. They were trying to get people interested in WrestleMania on the go-home show. It didn't really work, since WrestleMania that year pretty much bombed. WrestleMania 13 had, you know, one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time, but overall it was one of the worst WrestleMania shows. It wasn't the worst, but it was certainly way up there. But this was a very memorable moment on Raw. I remember wearing out the VHS cassette on my VCR because I rewound it so many times to go back and watch this long before the days of YouTube. I don't even know where that tape is now, but I'm sure it's practically unwatchable. It probably has lines through it and everything. We've now reached the top five greatest Raw moments in history, and number five on the list is one that I know all of us remember since it didn't really take place all that long ago. In fact, it only took place just last year, June 27th, 2011, the infamous CM Punk pipe bomb promo. CM Punk had been a three-time world heavyweight champion to this point, had won Money in the Bank twice, I believe, and was an Intercontinental champion, an ECW champion, and had some success, but had been pushed back down the card quite a bit. He was more almost a mid-card comedy act at this point. He had just come out of a feud with Big Show, where Big Show unmasked him. He was bald. Basically, they weren't doing jack shit with CM Punk. And obviously, he was tired of it. He was tired of being on the road. His contract was legitimately coming to an end. And I think it might have been on this show. He announced that on July 17th, his contract would be coming to an end. And CM Punk was to be getting a WWF Championship match, WWE, I should say, Championship match against John Cena at the next pay-per-view. And on this episode of Raw, John Cena actually had, I believe it was a tables match with R-Truth. And CM Punk came out at the end of the show. John Cena had been put through a table. He grabbed a microphone, walked back up the ramp, and sat down Indian style on stage, and proceeded to cut the mother of all work shoot promos. Basically, there was a mixture of a lot of his real feelings and real emotions, the way he really felt about certain things. So, for example, he really did feel slighted that The Rock waltzed back into the company and was getting the WrestleMania main event when guys like him, who had busted their ass, probably deserved it more than Rock did. And he talked about that. He talked about being passed over for movies and not having his face on a lot of different items like cups and spoons and event programs and the event open for the TV show and all these different things. And he said that, you know, he called himself a Paul Heyman guy, just like Brock. And it was Heyman who was a big advocate of him. It was actually Paul Heyman who wanted CM Punk to win the Extreme Elimination Chamber back at that awful December to Dismember pay-per-view in 06, which was the death knell for Paul Heyman, and one of the worst WWE pay-per-views of all time, both in terms of quality and in terms of the buy rate. I think it got like 90,000 buys or something horrendous like that. So he was definitely a Paul Heyman guy. And Punk talked about winning the championship and maybe going to New Japan Pro Wrestling or going back to Ring of Honor. He gave a shout out to his buddy Colt Cabana, who was not under contract to WWE at the time. And it was pretty groundbreaking stuff. I mean, we've seen shoot promos and work shoot promos before, but not very many of them in recent years. You know, we're in a different era now in wrestling. You know, we're in the PG era, and you just don't see a lot of this these days. And there's been a couple of moments on this countdown here where I've said, well, the product really needed to be shaken up. Unfortunately, I find myself saying that quite often. There's far too many moments where it feels like the product has to be shaken up. And this was one of those moments that definitely shook things up. And Punk started talking about the McMahon family. He insulted Stephanie. He insulted Triple H. He was starting to tell a story about the anti-bullying campaign and how Vince is really a bully. And then his mic got cut off, and they did a cutaway to end the show. They didn't put the copyright on the screen. They just cut the show off. It felt very real. It felt very organic. And CM Punk, in one interview, in one moment, in one promo, became the hottest commodity in wrestling. You know, and they were able to keep this up for a couple of weeks, and of course it led to Money in the Bank. Punk won the championship. It's almost impossible for me to fathom how well WWE actually handled that whole angle, at least until Punk came back too early. But they were doing everything right. From this promo to, which, you know, I don't want to give the company too much credit for the promo because the promo was more the brainchild of CM Punk, but I give Vince McMahon credit for allowing him to go out there and giving him the freedom to say the things he said before they cut his mic off. So, you know, they do deserve some credit for that. But this is a promo, I think, that even though we remember it because it's still fresh in our minds, it's only a little over a year old. I think 5 years from now, and probably even 10 years from now, we're going to look back on that promo and still remember it. And the biggest thing to me about this promo is this promo created a new star, a bona fide new star in WWE. CM Punk was a star, but he was not a main eventer. CM Punk headlined pay-per-views before. He headlined a SummerSlam once before, beat Jeff Hardy in a TLC match. But I don't think people really, truly looked at CM Punk as a main eventer. Certainly not at that point, because he had been shoved back down the card. What Punk went out there and did was, you know, he didn't care. Because in his mind, he really was legitimately leaving. It was up to the company if they wanted to keep him around, because they need people like him. It was up to the company if they wanted to keep him and make him an offer that he couldn't refuse. And obviously, by putting the title on him and making certain promises to him, he changed his mind. He changed his tune, and he stuck around, and he's been around ever since. And CM Punk is right behind John Cena as the biggest star in the company. So, you know, this was not let's push him for 6 months and then push him back down. This promo made him a superstar. And you can't find too many examples of one promo or one segment on one particular show really making a star the way that CM Punk made himself a star in this promo on June 27th of last year. So the significance of this promo cannot be understated. You know, CM Punk has been, a big star for the company. He's been champion now for about 8 months, sells a lot of merchandise, as far as I know, he's neck and neck with John Cena. Maybe he is the top merchandise seller in the company. Headlined WrestleMania this year in the title match, beat Chris Jericho. So he's the big time now, and it all goes back to that promo he cut last year, Indian style, on that stage during Raw. Speaking of making stars, that takes us to the number four moment on the countdown. January 19th, 1998, the night after the Royal Rumble pay-per-view, which Steve Austin won the Royal Rumble match, earning himself a title shot against Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 14. Vince McMahon's special guest on Raw the very next night was Iron Mike Tyson, who had been the biggest boxing attraction on pay-per-view, the biggest pay-per-view attraction, really, in the entire world. Even at that point, which by that point his career had mostly been over already. This is after the fights with Holyfield where he bit the ear and all that. But Tyson was still a hot commodity, and having him as part of WrestleMania was a big deal. And the question was, what was Vince McMahon going to announce? Was Tyson actually going to be wrestling? Was he going to be boxing at WrestleMania? Was he going to have a match with one of the superstars? Nobody really knew. And just before Vince McMahon could make the announcement about what Mike Tyson's role would be, out came Stone Cold Steve Austin. And the ring filled up with referees and Tyson's bodyguards and WWF officials. And Austin went face-to-face with Tyson. He cut a promo on him. He said he was sick and tired. He was throwing up in the locker room watching Tyson shaking everybody's hand. He basically said that he could beat up Mike Tyson. He could beat him any day of the week, twice on Sunday. And he said, if you don't understand what I'm hearing, I have got some sign language for you. And he proceeded to flip off the baddest man on the planet. Tyson shoved back. And then we had a brawl, a melee, or as Vince McMahon used to say, a melee, erupted in the middle of the ring. Austin went after Tyson. Tyson's bodyguards held him back. There was money falling out of people's pockets all over the ring. They were trying to subdue Austin on the mat. Vince McMahon was irate. He was beside himself. He kept shouting that Austin ruined it. You ruined it. He wouldn't say what he ruined. I guess potentially he ruined the deal with Tyson. But this was a big-time media moment. I remember seeing clips of this all over the local news here in New York on ABC, you know, Channel 7, Channel 4, Channel 2. I'm sure it was like that probably all over the country. This was part of the 5 o'clock and 11 o'clock newscasts, and it was probably on SportsCenter, too, back then. And that's exactly what WWF at the time was hoping for. They wanted as much media publicity out of Mike Tyson being part of this as they could possibly get. They were paying Tyson good money. Supposedly they were paying him $3 million or something close to that for his participation in WrestleMania. And you look back on it all these years later, and obviously however much money they paid Tyson, even if it really was $3 million, if that is the legitimate figure, and you always take things with a grain of salt. Remember, this is the company that claimed they paid Floyd Mayweather $20 million for WrestleMania 24, which, if that were true, which it wasn't, that was about $19 million too much. But whatever they paid Tyson, they made back in spades, because Tyson is one of those celebrities. You know, he's in the WWE Hall of Fame now. He deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Cyndi Lauper, who I'm sure will probably go in one day, maybe in New York next year. She was on Raw recently. Cyndi Lauper's participation in that whole rock and wrestling thing in the 80s cannot be understated. Her participation, she was a hot star back then. It really helped put the company on the map. You know, Donald Trump as well. You know, that WrestleMania 23 buy rate still stands at the biggest of all time for that whole Battle of the Billionaires thing, and a lot of credit goes to Trump for that because Trump has a big name. Mr. T, who wants nothing to do with wrestling, apparently. He also deserves a spot in the Hall of Fame because without Mr. T, that first WrestleMania is not a success. Mike Tyson has that same impact in WWF history as far as I'm concerned because, to me, that WrestleMania and maybe that whole era, quite frankly, is not as successful as it turned out to be without his participation. Steve Austin was going to be a, you know, the big star in the company no matter what, but would he have been as big as he went on to be as quickly as he did were it not for the rub that working with Mike Tyson helped give him in 98? I'm not sure. I mean, I think he would have, but maybe not. So this is a big moment. You know, Mike Tyson and Steve Austin going face-to-face, nose-to-nose in the middle of the ring. One of the biggest moments in Raw history, without question, and certainly big for the career of Steve Austin. The number three greatest moment in the history of Monday Night Raw, we go all the way back to September 28th, 1998. It was the night after the WWF Breakdown In Your House pay-per-view. There was a triple threat main event pitting Undertaker against Kane against Steve Austin for the WWF Championship. Undertaker and Kane, double choke slam to Austin. They both get the pin. So obviously we have a controversy now over who the champion is. Vince McMahon runs out, grabs Austin's smoking skull belt, and flees the arena with it. And the next night on Raw, Vince McMahon has the old WWF Championship belt that he is has encased in glass. And he has the red carpet out. He is going to announce the new champion, whether it's Undertaker or Kane. Whoever it is, Vince is very happy that the title is off Austin. And Austin will have none of this. He forces his way into the arena, driving a Zamboni. Now, Austin, I mentioned earlier, has driven a lot of vehicles in his day. He's driven his pickup truck, of course, but he's also driven monster trucks and beer trucks and, I mean, God knows what else. He used to have that little, not a scooter, but the vehicle that he would drive to the ring when he was the sheriff, the ATV. Well, the Zamboni is still my favorite of all these vehicles. My absolute favorite top Steve Austin vehicular moment, if you will, is the Zamboni incident, as it is now dubbed, from this episode of Raw in 1998. This was so freaking awesome. He drives the Zamboni into the arena, and in doing so, he accidentally crushes one of the lights that was standing off to the side. So he runs over the light. He keeps barreling towards the arena, comes up by the side of the Titantron, turns to go down the aisle. Obviously, there was no stage, which back in the day, during that time period, when there was no stage and no Raw ramp, that usually was an indication that there was going to be something going on with some sort of car or vehicle. And sure enough, here comes Austin and the Zamboni. Everybody is in the ring. The ring is just surrounded by police officers guarding McMahon. Undertaker and Kane are in the ring. Briscoe and Patterson, everybody's there. And Austin drives the Zamboni right up to the ring and literally moves the ring. The ring actually moved because he crashed into the ring. He's probably drunk when he drove down to the ring. And he turns the engine off, climbs on top of the Zamboni, and launches himself off the Zamboni, over the cops, right onto McMahon in the ring. Starts beating the crap out of Vince McMahon in the middle of the ring. And funny enough, somebody threw a big blow-up, like a Steve Austin blow-up doll of some kind, into the ring, which is just laying in the ring through all of this, which I think is kind of funny. The cops pull Austin off of McMahon. Undertaker and Kane are just kind of indifferent to the whole thing. They're just standing around. I remember it was so loud, and I think when Austin ran down to drove the Zamboni to the ring, he ran over some cables and wires, and he knocked out some of the audio, because I think the audio was off, then the audio came back, and it was all fucked up. So the audio was all messed up, and it was even louder than it really was. It was loud enough in the building. But the way the audio was all messed up, it made it even louder. I had to lower the volume on my TV. It was just complete pandemonium. And Austin's trying to go after McMahon. McMahon's kicking at Austin. And the cops drag Austin off. And McMahon goes off. And, I mean, this crowd was electric. Absolutely electric. It's just one of those moments that gives you goosebumps when you watch it as a fan. And And it didn't end there, because when they came back from commercial, McMahon was back in the ring. Undertaker and Kane were in the ring as well. Everybody else had cleared out. And obviously McMahon was none too pleased over what had just happened. And instead of announcing who the champion was, he decided, you know what, neither one of you guys did anything to help me, so, you know, screw it. I'm not going to announce a champion. I'm going to make a match for the next pay-per-view. Undertaker, you're going to fight Kane. And McMahon has some unsavory comments for both of them. Undertaker then threatens McMahon. As if poor Vince, as if he hasn't been through enough on this show. And Undertaker grabs him by the suit, and he threatens him, and he says, you know, because Vince McMahon had referred to them as handicapped. He said that Kane's handicap is physical and the Undertaker is mentally handicapped. So the Undertaker responded to Vince by saying if he mouths off to them one more time, he's going to be the one handicapped, which I thought was kind of a cool comeback. And as Undertaker and Kane go to leave, Vince McMahon goes to flip off the Undertaker. And as he's putting the fingers up, Undertaker turns around and he catches him in the act. And that was it. That's all you need to do to set The Undertaker off. He pummeled Vince McMahon into oblivion. Kane got in on it. They're both kicking the crap out of Vince McMahon. And Undertaker puts Vince McMahon in some sort of weird leg lock. And he's ripping and tearing at the knee. And Kane is keeping Patterson and Briscoe at bay. The crowd is going apeshit again. They drag McMahon out of the ring. And they take the ring steps and they smash his ankle. And this was the start of Vince McMahon appearing on Raw in a wheelchair, which I think he probably appeared on the show in a wheelchair for a good 2 months. And this is also where they stole the idea to have John Laurinaitis come out in his little people power mobile. They stole it directly from this storyline. So, you know, very similar to the show where Jericho beat Triple H for the title, and then in the very next segment they took the title away from him. Those two segments back-to-back were great television, and the crowd was going nuts for all of it. Same thing here. The segment with Austin on the Zamboni was great TV. They came back from commercial, and they went right into the next angle, where, you know, Undertaker and Kane literally put Vince McMahon in the hospital. And, again, great television. Just great, exciting television. And this is what Vince Russo became known for back then, because a lot of these ideas were his. And again, when Russo worked for the WWF, a lot of his ideas, everything had to go through Vince McMahon. So the really wild and crazy ideas probably either never made it to television, or what we ended up seeing on TV was kind of the modified, kind of less whacked out version that Vince McMahon wanted us to see. And back then, Vince Russo had some pretty cool ideas. This was, you know, their idea of Crash TV at the time, back when Crash TV actually worked and it was actually good. And you had performers like Austin and Undertaker and Vince McMahon, who was an excellent performer and can really pull it off and make this work. And this was one of those magical nights where everything just came together. And it wasn't a technical wrestling match or a promo or anything like that. It was just really fucking fun television. And to me, I don't think this show and these segments get enough credit. You know, people always point to the debut of Mr. Sacco and you know, the same things over and over again. And those were great moments, don't get me wrong. But to me, when you want to see an exciting segment of wrestling television, go back and watch both these segments, the Zamboni incident and the segment that followed, and tell me that that's not exciting wrestling television, because I sure as hell think it is. It's one of my favorite all-time Raw moments. The number two greatest Raw moment of all time came on January 4th, 1999. It was actually a tape show that technically was taped the year before, in December of 98, but it didn't air until January 4th. It was the infamous, that'll put the butts in seats comment from Tony Schiavone on WCW Monday Nitro when about a million viewers or something like that turned the channel from TNT to USA Network to see Mankind defeat The Rock to become the WWF champion for the very first time, with a little bit of an assist from Stone Cold Steve Austin. Austin had been off television for only a couple of weeks, so it's kind of similar to when Kane made his big comeback in 2000. I talked about that earlier in the countdown, this big grand return, which was funny only because Kane had been off TV a few weeks. Same thing here with Austin. He wasn't off television for very long, but the pop that Austin got when he came out, I think Dave Meltzer was actually in the audience that night. I'm not sure why. I know the show was in Lowell, Massachusetts. I know Meltzer lives in the West Coast, but I remember him once saying that he was actually at that show. But regardless, anybody who was in the building that night would tell you that they have never heard a reaction ever in their entire lifetime to any one person the way that they heard the fans react to Steve Austin that night when the glass shattered. And if you watch that moment on television, if you saw it live, or if you go back and watch it, the announcers, Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, were almost drowned out by the sound of the audience noise. It was so loud, you couldn't hear anything except just screaming and shouting. It was a match between Mankind and The Rock. Corporation was at ringside. DX was at ringside in the corner of Mick Foley. And towards the end of the match, Foley had the mandible claw on Rock. Ken Shamrock ran in, gave him a chair shot to the back. Billy Gunn ran in to attack Shamrock. Now on the outside, there's brawling between DX and the Corporation. And that's when the glass shattered. Steve Austin ran down. Well, he didn't run down, but he kind of jogged down to the ring. Grabbed a chair, blasted Rock in the head with the chair, pulled Foley on top of Rock. Referee Earl Hebner counts 1, 2, 3, and just like that, we have a new champion. Now, this was shocking at the time, only because, number one, I don't think anybody expected Mankind to ever become champion, and number two, you didn't see a world title change very often on a taped show. Remember, back then, Raw was not live every week. This was a taped show, and I actually remember being pretty pissed off because I went on WWF.com at the time, and they spoiled the whole goddamn thing. It was like the front page main story on the website, 5-6 days in advance after it had happened at the tapings, and they spoiled the whole goddamn thing on their website, and I was pretty PO'd about it, but in all likelihood, I would have found out about it anyway, if for no other reason, because Tony Schiavone on the other channel went ahead and spoiled it by saying that, on the other show, Mick Foley, who used to wrestle here as Cactus Jack, is going to win their world title. That'll put the butts in seats. And that was a comment that was fed to him by Eric Bischoff. I think Tony Schiavone gets too much flack unnecessarily for that comment. It's not like he went into business for himself and said that without somebody telling him to. But it was a pretty dumb thing for Eric Bischoff to do, that's for damn sure, because a lot of people wanted to see Mick Foley apparently win the championship. And it was a special moment, and the match was over. DX is hoisting him up on their shoulders, and Foley got to cut a promo and tell his kids, Daddy did it. And he did the whole jog around, the lap around the ring with the title belt held high in the air. And the only thing missing from this was the commentary of Jim Ross, who had followed Foley through his entire career. And, used to talk about Foley being Mrs. Foley's baby boy. And unfortunately, he had suffered another attack of Bell's palsy a few weeks earlier. Michael Cole was filling in for him on commentary. And as bad as Michael Cole can be now, really, Michael Cole is terrible now because of his heel shtick. As a regular announcer, Cole is not that bad. But back then, he wasn't trying to be a heel. He was just an announcer, but he was very inexperienced, and so he was even worse, if you can believe it. And we had to endure him shouting at the top of his lungs, trying to make this a special moment. I'm sure Jim Ross was probably in the headset feeding him lines, but without JR actually on commentary, it just wasn't the same. Even Mick Foley himself has made that remark before. No offense to Michael Cole, but I wish JR were there to have called this moment. So that was about the only thing missing. Otherwise, it's one of the all-time famous Raw moments. Foley winning the championship, the Stone Cold pop, Tony Schiavone's dumbass remark on Nitro. Everything just came together very well for WWF on this night. And it made for one of the more memorable Raw broadcasts in the show's history. And now it's time for the number one greatest moment in the history of Monday Night Raw. I feel like we need a drum roll for this. Let's get a good drum roll going here. Here we go. The number one moment, March 31st, 2008. The retirement of one of the greatest wrestlers, if not the greatest wrestler of all time, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. This was the night after WrestleMania 24 in Orlando. Flair, of course, losing to the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels in a pretty good match. Flair comes out on Raw the next night, cuts a promo, and is interrupted by Triple H, one of his best friends in the business. And what followed was, I don't see how anybody can call it anything other than one of the greatest segments in the history of this entire show, maybe any wrestling show. Normally, when we see people, they're being embarrassed on Monday Night Raw. We've certainly seen plenty of legends embarrassed and made fun of on television, or people who retire and then they come back a couple of weeks later. And, of course, Flair did come back. He wrestled against Hulk Hogan on an Australian tour, and he went to TNA. But Flair never has come back in WWE, so that must count for something. But regardless of what Flair ended up doing after this, as far as retirement ceremonies go, Ric Flair got the single greatest retirement ceremony that any professional wrestler could ever hope to get, and probably that anybody ever will get. Triple H introduced the Four Horsemen. Arn Anderson came out. Dean Malenko. Plenty of legends that Flair has worked with over the course of his career and befriended over the years. People like Harley Race, who, of course, was a mentor to him, and he beat Harley, that famous Starrcade Flair for the gold back in 83 when he won the NWA World Championship for what I believe was the second time. And Ricky the Dragon Steamboat was introduced. Greg the Hammer Valentine, who he had worked with and I think tagged with earlier in his career. And a lot of the current wrestlers as well. Dave Bautista, who Ric Flair had befriended. And people like Shawn Michaels and Chris Jericho and John Cena. His own family, his daughters, his sons, his wife, now ex-wife. Just a whole laundry list of who's who in the wrestling business from the past and the present were brought down to the ring to celebrate the life and times of the Nature Boy Ric Flair. Flair is a very emotional guy, so obviously, I mean, if he stubs his toe, he probably starts crying. And Flair was just crying a river of tears, and Shawn Michaels did come out, and they showed off the Rolexes that they had exchanged, and it was just a really, really touching moment. They kept playing that damn Leave the Memories Alone song, which I'll have burned in my brain for the rest of my life. Of course, Triple H, they brought out the entire Raw roster, who came out and gave Flair a standing ovation, and Flair is just a bubbling, I don't even know what you would call the guy, just, you know, tears streaming down his face. And when the show went off the air, we know that Undertaker was introduced. This was a DVD extra, I think. Undertaker did the whole Undertaker entrance. The wrestlers in the aisleway, they parted the Red Sea to allow the Undertaker to come down. And Undertaker hugged Flair, and he gave him the Undertaker salute. He knelt down in front of him in the ring. And Vince McMahon himself came down to the ring and embraced Flair. He was so exuberant, Vince McMahon, that if you go back and watch the footage of him celebrating with Flair when he grabs Flair's arm and goes to put Flair's hand in the air, he almost ripped Flair's arm out of his socket. I mean, Flair was, I mean, he was coming off his feet. Vince McMahon kept, you know, holding his arm up and flinging it in the air so hard. I felt sorry for the poor guy. But Vince was all smiles and really a perfect fitting tribute to one of, if not the greatest wrestler of all time. I personally wish Flair never would have come back in a wrestling capacity, because it wasn't worth it. It wasn't like Flair was going to go out there and have another four-star match again. The closest he came, I guess, maybe was that bloodbath him and Foley had that one time on Impact. But really, was it worth it? To me, it would have been perfect if he would have just left well enough alone. But it doesn't matter. For one night, if you just, you know, you look at the tribute, it was the perfect tribute, the best tribute any wrestler could ever ask for. I think there have been a few that have been a lot bigger and grander, maybe in Japan for some of the legendary figures over there, but certainly nothing in this country that even comes close to the kind of tribute that Flair got. And, you know, as other guys retire, like Triple H and Undertaker and, you know, guys like that, we'll see what kind of tributes they get. I can't see somebody like a Triple H getting the same sort of heartfelt tribute that Ric Flair got. Ric Flair, he inspired so many guys who were coming up, so many young wrestlers who wanted to, you know, mimic him and imitate him, Triple H among them. If you look at old photos of Triple H when he was first coming up with Killer Kowalski with the robe and the blonde hair, I mean, he was a dead ringer for Ric Flair. It was obvious who his influence was. Countless wrestlers that Ric Flair influenced, who were all out there paying homage to one of the greatest of all time. And say what you want to about Flair. I have, a lot of people have, and again, the fact that he did ultimately go on to wrestle again, but it doesn't matter. To me, it's easily the greatest moment in the history of Raw. If you're a wrestling fan, if you're a real wrestling fan, you can't help but watch that and not shed a tear, at least the first time. It was that emotional to see all those guys out there paying homage to this guy. It was really something special. And if I remember correctly, the whole segment went like 20 minutes overtime. Raw went off the air that night at like 11:20 something. They went well over time, but it was well worth it. I'm glad they were able to show the whole thing, and just a really, really special moment. And I don't know, again, that we'll ever see anything quite like that in the history of Monday Night Raw ever again on the show. It would be nice to, because there's a lot of guys, I think, who deserve a tribute like that, but maybe none more so than Flair, because Flair probably will go down as the greatest of all time at his craft. There really hasn't been another performer like him. I don't know that there ever will be. So That's the number one Raw moment in history, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure that may differ from some of your lists. But that's the beauty of doing a list like this. It's totally subjective. So there you go. The top 30 moments in the history of Monday Night Raw. I hope you enjoyed this special edition of The Sound Off, a 2.5 hour edition of the Sound Off. I promise they're not all this long. This was a special edition. And it's a good thing I didn't do a top 50, or else I'd be here all day. But hopefully you enjoyed the list. Feel free to leave comments in the post on SEScoops.com underneath with your feedback and thoughts, and maybe some moments that you feel were neglected from the list. There were a lot of moments I tried to get on the list, even, you know, the debut of Mr. Socko with Dr. Austin in the hospital, and just so many other moments that I just, you know, could not fit into the top 30. It's very hard to put a list like this together, so I understand that there were some glaring omissions, but in my opinion, this is the top 30, and I wanted to try to mix it up a little bit, too, and get a nice variety from all the different years and all the different eras, and I'd like to think I covered a lot of ground here. At least I hope so. So if you have any feedback for me, direct, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster is the handle, and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolemonster. And if you've never checked out a normal episode of The Solemn Monster Sounds Off, like I said, I promise you they're not all this long. Check it out. I think you might like it. If you've seen it on the website before but never have given it a chance, give it a chance. I really think you may enjoy it. They usually go up every weekend, usually on Sundays, and you can check it out on SEScoops.com. Where else? So that's going to do it for this very special edition. I'm the Solemn Monster. I want to thank each and every one of you for taking the time to check out this Top 30 Raw Moments podcast. Hopefully you will enjoy the 1,000th episode of Raw on July 23rd, and hopefully that show will give us some more moments that we can add on to future lists. So until next time, be well, stay safe, and everybody enjoy Raw on July 23rd, episode 1,000. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemn Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.